Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the very first episode of my new summer radio show titled Churco & Company with yours truly, Vito Churco, and my special guest co-host for today's episode in Brendan Kudla of Elma College. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, V. Thanks for having me on.
So, Kudla, first off, looking at this Tigers game right now on Fox Sports Detroit for the two of us, and Tigers trailed early 3-0. Anibal Sanchez had some trouble in the first inning, threw a bunch of pitches, totaling 30-something. Trouble with his control, too. I believe two base on balls in that particular inning, Kudla, and it got him in trouble. And the Twins scored two runs in the first, I believe, then another. They tacked on another in the second against Anibal. Still good K rate for the game for Anibal overall-wise, but not as sharp to start off the game.
Yeah, I kind of saw this coming today out of Anibal Sanchez. I saw they just knocked up the fourth run, 4-2 now Twins, in the top of the seventh with Bruce Rendon on the hill. But for Anibal Sanchez, after coming off a start where you get 17 strikeouts and you're kind of feeling it in the zone, I kind of thought he was going to be trying to hit the corners just a little bit more and go for another high strikeout day as he had last start, and that might lead to a couple walks, and it proved to be right there on the early going. So it was nice to see him settle down and really finish out his game pretty strongly, only giving up 3 earned in 6 innings, which is a quality start. But I kind of saw the walks coming just a little bit.
Yeah, he definitely pitched good enough to win today, Kudla, but the bats didn't show up until last inning, honestly, when they scored their first two runs of the game. Cabrera drove in one for the second run, and then before that, we also saw another one driven in, and that was by, who scored the first run for the Tigers today? I know Cabrera drove in the second one to make it 3-2 before this inning.
I believe Torrey Hunter had the first RBI hit, and then Cabrera had the RBI double afterwards.
So, I mean, it was good to see the offense finally show up, but maybe a little bit too late. There's still some time, though, here, but Rondon just gave up a run to make it 4-2 Twins, like you said, Kudla, and right now, I don't know about Rondon. I think his control is not good enough, and it seems like he just tries to overthrow and tries to overpower guys with his, you know, triple-digit fastball that he can hit in the triple digits on a consistent basis. However, I don't think he's sharp enough right now with the command of his pitches to really get guys out on a consistent basis, especially in a late-inning situation.
Yeah, Bruce Rendon, he's kind of got a little bit of the Joel Zamaya syndrome going on right now, where he can light up the radar gun, and he knows it. So every time he goes out there, I feel like he's going to try to hit triple digits. And in the big leagues, that's not going to work. He'll find that out quick enough. But I think it's nice to have Valverde back, someone that's been in that closing role for years. And he'll be able to use a little bit of tutelage and knowledge to help Bruce Rendon form into that closer in the future. So maybe he might not be ready now, but next year or the year after, I could see the passing of the torch from Valverde down to Bruce Rendon.
And that's if Rendon gains control of his fastball and his other pitches, because he needs to develop another dominant pitch outside of his triple-digit fastball. Because we've seen him be able to do that. We know he can, but how about the other pitches, Kudla? Talk about those and the effectiveness of those right now, because I believe he's lacking something as of right now. And he probably is a little bit raw, and he's showing that off in the major leagues thus far. And just walked another guy as I was talking.
Yeah, definitely. He needs to develop a second pitch, whether it's his slider that he does have. If he gains control or command of his slider, that could be deadly with a 100-mile-an-hour fastball and then drop down to even a 90-mile-an-hour slider. It doesn't matter. As long as you have two pitches that you can locate effectively, like you see with Al Albuquerque, that's someone Bruce Rendon can take notes off of. His slider is absolutely off the charts, one of the best in the game, and he does have an above-average fastball. When he's able to locate both of them, it's deadly and you're unable to hit him. So he needs to work on that, hopefully by next year, because I'm not going to put too much pressure on him to learn a whole new pitch and gain command of that when he doesn't have complete command of his number one pitch, which is his fastball during his rookie year.
And it's not going to happen right now in the big leagues, him developing control and effectiveness with other pitches. He's going to have to rely on that overpowering fastball and hope that it gains some movement and it's not just a straight fastball that's thrown over the plate, because when you throw it over the plate, big league hitters, I don't care who you are, if you're a Minnesota Twin, a Miami Marlin, or a member of the Boston Red Sox or New York Yankees, you're going to tee off on that pitch right over the plate, even at 100 miles per hour. And that's the thing he's going to have to learn, to become more of a pitcher and not just a thrower.
Yeah, he threw three straight pitches at 101 miles an hour, and on the third one, Aaron Hicks, an absolute nobody for the Minnesota Twins, lined a triple in the right center field corner. So, I mean, he's going to have to learn quick enough that, hey, 101's fast, but you're in the majors now, so they're going to be able to hit that.
And honestly, Kudla, I believe the Twins have enough hitting in their lineup right now to contend. Now, the thing is, though, they lack the starting arms and that dominant number one starting pitcher at the front of their rotation. They do not possess that right now and have not since the days of Johan Santana. And you know what? That was a long time ago now. That was, I believe, back in 06 the last time they had him, maybe 07. But that's a good 5 or 6 years ago now. And they haven't possessed that number one true ace-caliber starting pitcher since the days of him. And I guess Liriano to a degree, but Liriano was not the same guy. Was not the same frontline starter last year, even the year before that. And that's why they dealt him and barely got anything in return for him.
Yeah, Liriano, he was a good pitcher. I wouldn't consider him to be a true number one. He had a lot of strikeouts, but he also threw a lot of walks into the mix as well. They have a good, solid base for a rotation in Vance Worley and Scott Diamond, but obviously they don't have that number one pitcher. Those guys could be good two and threes in the league, but they need to go out. If they want to make some noise in the Central, go out and really got to get a pitcher as like James Shields that the Kansas City Royals were able to snatch up somehow, some way.
And the Royals are a different ball club now with him and Jeremy Guthrie also, as we've seen him be really solid for them, pretty much as their number two slotted right behind James, big game Shields.
Yeah.
I believe that's their difference right now, the top of the rotation, the difference between their club this season, Kudla, and last year's KC Royals team.
Yeah, it's been the difference between their team in the past 10 years, for that matter. Yeah, when they had Zach Greinke, they still didn't have a number two. Now they have a solid 1-2 punch to go at the top of their rotation, along with a lot of young bats and a lot of ability on that team. And that's why they are currently at the second spot in the AL Central, only a half game behind your Tigers.
And you know what? They're not going to I think, beat up on the Tigers and catapult into first place over the Tigers this season in the AL Central. However, with their stronger starting pitching staff, that 1-2 at the top, 1-2 punch in James Shields and then Jeremy Guffrey as the number two starter, along with quality hitters, quality young guys in the middle of their order, and Billy Butler, the DH, Hosmer and Moustakas as well, along with Alex Gordon. We can't forget about him. If those guys show up and prove to produce up to their capabilities this season for the KC Royals, Kudla, they could be a very competitive ball club. And not only in the AL Central, but as a whole throughout the whole entire American League this season.
Yeah, they all have to grow and develop just a little bit. I still think they're maybe 1 or 2 years out, just purely based off of the fact that Hosmer and Moustakas are still very, very young.
Yeah.
And I don't think they really hit their complete peak yet, along with even Chris Getz at second base. Yeah, his bat isn't completely there, but he's very solid defensively and very quick if he does get on the bases. And it's quick to look over Alcides Escobar, who had the second highest average as an American League shortstop last year.
Yeah.
So the Royals are an up-and-coming team, and that's a team that everyone's going to need to start looking out for. And it looks like all the trading and jokes that we made about the Royals are looking to come and bite us, because their managers, or their general manager, knew what was up getting all these young guns, because they're coming to play, that's for sure.
And how about their catcher in the young Salvador Perez, too, who can hit the baseball on a consistent basis? He's a guy to watch out for, too, in their lineup.
Another young talent. That's a team that I'm going to be hot on in these next few years. And I forgot to even look. They have Irvin Santana as their number two
now
for Kansas City.
They have Santana, who was really bad, though, last season for the Halos and the year before. Very unreliable. Now, he could produce that one really good dominant start. Thing is, it wasn't happening on a consistent basis. It was very rare to get a start like that out of Irvin Santana, dating back to even two and a half years ago in that Halos rotation.
Yeah,
now, they need
a
different Irvin Santana, Kudla, or he's just going to be a bottom-of-the-rotation guy. And honestly, I believe that's where he realistically, talent-wise, pitches from. I think he has the status of a back end of the rotation starter at this point in his career, because he isn't reliable enough.
Yeah, he shows those flashes of brilliance that always spark my attention. I'm sure spark others' attention as well. That's always what keeps me going to him. And I'm looking over on this KC Royals starting staff right now. Wade Davis is another guy that very, very, very much so intrigues me.
He was a relief pitcher last year, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I think he's a better relief pitcher, more effective out of the pen.
Yeah, I think he might need time to develop and really figure out where he should go in the starting rotation or in relief. But he's a guy that could go either way. If he develops to be a very quality starting pitcher, he could be another guy that could cause our Detroit Tigers a little bit of a skirmish, I guess, at the top of the AL Central.
Mm-hmm. So they need to widen out that rotation and get quality arms from 1 through 5. Because that's the difference between the Tigers and the Royals right now. They're top-heavy with Big Game James, Jeremy Guthrie, and the rest of their guys are smelly, are inconsistent, and I wouldn't count on them, to say the least, to produce quality starts on a consistent basis, including the likes of guys we've mentioned in Irvin Santana, Wade Davis, who I believe, like I said, Kudla, is much more effective out of the pen. And he was for the Rays last season, before the Royals acquired him and James Shields this offseason. For a top prospect, too, and Will Myers, who they had to give up in that deal.
Yeah, that was a big deal right there, giving up Wade Myers, who's going to be a very, very quality professional one day when his time comes. And one thing that both, I believe, the Tigers and the Royals semi-lack right now is that bullpen presence. Don't really have that go-to arm that's a shutdown, even calling back Valverde. Like, Phil Koch had a terrible year so far. I mean, the year is very young, him going on the DL.
And now Koch's on the DL, too. It's on the 15-day DL, too.
Yeah, so it's another thing that could cause problems for the Tigers, and that's where you lose games, is in the back end of that bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
Albuquerque's been our strongest arm this year out of the pen, in my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to need more than one guy, that's for sure. We got Darren Downs on the hill right now with the bases loaded and one out for the Tigs, and still looking to be down 4-2.
Yeah, and Kudla, I think Albuquerque LL potentially has the best stuff out of all the bullpen arms at the back end of our pen. Options that could close out games this season and going into the immediate future. Because we see that ball come out of his hand and it just drops on hitters. And he racks up K's left and right because of it. I think the concern with Leland and the Tigers, though, for LL is his health. Was not healthy for a full season last year, and then came out of nowhere in 2011 onto the scene as a great performer out of our pen. So I think they want to see him stay healthy over the duration and course of a full major league season before they hand over the keys to the closer role to LL. Because honestly, I'm not trusting Papa Grande or Rondon much more at this point than I would trust Albuquerque in the ninth inning.
Yeah, no, I can't trust anybody right now in the back of the bullpen. I just try to put all the trust I possibly can into Papa Grande that he can go out there and close some games. And he's done it so far. His first two times, he's been able to go out there and do the job, but a lot of deep fly balls, that are kind of scary. I mean, when he gives up a fly ball, it's just flashbacks at Yankee Stadium left and right in my mind.
Yep, Raul Ibanez going deep, and it was scary watching that. And throughout the whole postseason with Papa Grande, because he was not the same pitcher last year. He was a one-pitch pitcher. His velocity sucked, too. But it seems like he's regained that form and velocity, and he's more than a one-pitch pitcher at this point now. Thing is, can he continue with that form and pitching like that throughout the course of this full season for the Tigers? And in the closer role, too, at the same time, or is that too much to expect from Valverde at this point and stage in his career, which I believe it might be, Kudla?
Yeah, it could be a little bit too late for Jose. I'm going to keep my trust with him and keep my back burners on Al Albuquerque, because he's the man for the job, in my opinion. If Valverde starts struggling, I'm not going to trust Phil Koch or Phil Choke, as I sometimes call him. Al's got to do the job with that nasty slider. His slider brings back memories of a little bit Fernando Rodney's changeup that was just so lethal that every time he threw it, you figured there was going to be an out or a double play or a strikeout, anything good that could happen for the Tigers.
And how unlucky have the Tigers been, too, with the closer role? All these guys in recent memory, dating back to 06 for sure, have been roller coaster pitchers in the ninth inning. Todd Jones, for sure, was. Always was. Fernando Rodney with the Tigers was. And now we know of Papa Grande. Always, always a roller coaster. Never an easy 1-2-3 inning. Besides for his first outing as closer this season, Kudla. But like you said, some deep fly balls, too, that concern you going forward.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's been scary as a Tigers fan for years. Dealing with Todd Jones, Papa Grande, everybody down the line, Fernando Rodney. The one good thing I could potentially say, though, is Jose Valverde and Todd Jones both had 300 career saves in their illustrious careers that they've had, and that's the one bonus. I mean, they get the job done, but it sure looks ugly at some point.
It takes a long time, doesn't it? And there's always hits sprayed out all over the field, the walks, guys left on base. They put themselves in so much trouble, but you know what? For the most part, like you said, they got the job done, including Todd Jones, without dominant, overpowering stuff.
Yeah, my favorite quote ever was by Todd Jones himself. He goes, yeah, I usually just try to throw it 85 miles an hour over the heart of the plate before they find out that I can't throw anything else.
Yeah, he would just get it over the plate, as simple as that. And he didn't care how hard he could throw it because he knew he couldn't throw it in the mid to upper 90s. He was just basically getting it over there to let the guys hit it, put it in play. And that's all he did and he was known for throughout his entire career. But it worked for him, surprisingly, Kudla, as we both know.
You got nine players in the field for a reason. I guess that's why Todd Jones took the approach he did. You throw it over the plate, you hope they can make some plays and get out of there in three outs, because that's all he's got to get as a closer.
Now, Kudla, let's look at one of the current Tigers starting pitchers now, and fifth starter Rick Porcello, who has struggled for the most part throughout all his starts this season thus far for the Tigers. Now, last start, only a few runs, I believe three he let up in his last outing. Now, it was a struggle at first, though, but once he calmed down and settled in, he was fine. Still shaky, though, to a large degree, and a little bit too shaky for my liking, Kudla, especially when I know the Tigers have Drew Smyly in their pen. Very effective thus far out of the pen, and he's a lefty, which makes him that much more valuable. And especially at the back end of the Tigers' rotation, when you're not counting on him for that much. So talk about that a little bit, and whether or not Jim Leland and the Tigers should maybe turn to Drew Smyly as a fifth starter going forward. And if that's the case, what do they do with Rick Porcello?
Right now, I'm sticking with Rick Porcello. Personally, I understand his stats haven't been well, and he had that big blow-up start out in L.A., But for some reason, there's something that gets me to like what Slick Rick does starting games. Yeah, sometimes he can be wild, but a lot of the hits that he's given up this year, watching almost all of his starts, is he gets in there, and a lot of them are just cheap hits. We don't have the best defensive lineup, and that's what killed us when he was out in Los Angeles. I gave the one start, he gave up 9 runs, and off after the right before the Grand Slam, there's like 3 infield hits. So
yep. A lot of cheap, lucky hits before that Grand Slam.
Yeah, just a lot of cheap hits that really bolster his ERA. Now it's at an 8.84, which, yeah, you don't want that as a major league pitcher, that's for sure. But he's still so young, and that's what really intrigues me about Porcello. He has so much experience, and he's young, and he's still working on his craft that if I were the Tigers, I would probably put Smiley down in AAA and see if he could work. And if he does a great job, then, okay, bring him up for spot starts for Rick Porcello, and then if worse comes to worse, you option to trade Rick Porcello for somebody, because I'm sure he has worth on the market considering of his age and experience and what he's done in a postseason game as well, the play-in game in Minnesota that we had years ago where he pitched his brains out and just had a great start
uh-huh.
and a great game.
And even coming out of the pen last postseason, Kudla.
Yeah, he
pretty
got ice in his veins. That's one thing I really like about Rick is no matter what the situation is, you can always count on him to make a good pitch or no matter what, because he does not get intimidated by the situation, something that we are unsure of with Drew Smiley. And I kind of trust Rick Porcello making that big pitch, that big out. We've seen it in the playoffs several different occasions.
And for you, it's because he has the experience, and that's the factor, the advantage he holds over Drew Smiley at this point. As
yeah,
a starting pitcher in the big leagues.
A lot of experience over Drew Smiley, and experience is something that I count on a lot, because if you've been in a certain situation and you understand what needs to be done, you can channel in back to prior experiences. When you're on the hill and you got a tough spot, you can look back to the game in Minnesota a couple years ago. Hey, in Minnesota, I made that pitch. I can do it again. Or I did it last year.
Wasn't that a long time ago, though, now, too, in 2009? I mean, that's dating back 3-4 years ago when the Tigers were almost a totally different ball club back then.
They were.
You know what I mean?
Different.
That was his rookie season, too.
It was his rookie season, and it was a long time ago, but he also did it last year. So you can, as a player, you can go back in your mind and come back to certain situations where you can really psych yourself up and be like, I can make this pitch. I can do it. I've done it in my past. And I feel like the mental aspect of baseball is so much more in-depth and more meaningful than the physical aspect, because if you aren't there mentally, you see it with even all-stars and future Hall of Famers like Alex Rodriguez. If his mind's not in the game, he's not going to perform. So if he can go back to those certain times in Minnesota or last year in Texas where he made the pitches and got the outs and did a good job for the Tigers, that's what I count on, and that's why I think I'll stick with Rick and all his experience over the young Drew Smiley.
Well, let me ask you this, though. Out of all the performances now you've seen out of Rick Porcello, now, he's been in the big leagues long enough and hasn't shown dominance on a consistent basis. Could you still see him at this point in his career being a young starting pitcher, turning the corner and becoming that upper echelon starting pitcher, a frontline caliber starter who can produce as a number two or even a number three in the Tigers' rotation or another major league ball club's rotation in the very near future? Talk about that a little bit.
Right now, I can't see Rick Porcello becoming a front line at one or two in the Tigers' rotation, purely based off of who we have. And the expectations of Rick Porcello aren't that high. And to be completely honest with you, I don't think that he expects that much out of himself to be a top-tier one or two pitcher. I think he's almost complacent in the role that he's in and working to become the three or four and just a consistent inside-the-rotation guy. Maybe if you send him out to a different organization, someone less known for starting pitching, like maybe the Chicago Cubs or someone along, or the San Diego Padres, Miami Marlins, he might have that drive to work to become the best and the number one on that organization. But right now, I can only see him peaking in the Tigers organization as a 3-4 starter. Right now, he's in the fifth row. I can see him improving by maybe 2 years from now, getting up to that third starter spot and maybe taking over for someone like Doug Fister or Max Scherzer.
And Kudla, something that I thought I would never have said in my lifetime as a Tigers baseball fan, but I think right now I miss Jerry Laird as the Tigers' backup catcher. Seeing Brian Pena so far, now he had that big the ball he caught at home plate that he held on to in extra innings against the M's, in which the Tigers won that ball game. One of the best moments and highlights from the Tigers season thus far. But consistently producing at the plate is something that Pena is not known for and hasn't shown thus far this season, on top of the fact that Avila has 3 home runs and 3 ribbies only. So a lot of solo shots and not a lot of stuff has been produced out of Avila in those key timely situations with guys on and guys in scoring position, and only hitting around 200 this season as well. For me, that's not getting the job done. I don't expect a lot of offense out of a starting catcher or a backup as well, for sure. But thing is, I expect a little bit more than what the Tigers have gotten out of Pena and Avila thus far. So talk about that and whether or not you're concerned for Avila going forward. And then also the backup catcher position with Pena.
I'm a little bit concerned for our backup catcher more than I am for Alex, because since Alex Avila has gotten into the league, we've kind of adapted to him being more of a defensive catcher and the offense not exactly being there. Yeah, he has a little bit of power on occasions that we can see. And it's one of those things that I'm a little bit nervous for Pena more than I am Avila, because Laird did the job. And one thing that was always, I feel like, the driving force on why Gerald Laird got out of Detroit both times when he went to St. Louis and now Atlanta, I believe, is he wanted
all
to be
the winning
starter.
Ball clubs. All these winning ball clubs, too.
Yeah, winning ball clubs want Gerald Laird. Good locker room guy. And I think one of the things is he has the ability to be a starter. He's shown it to Detroit, and he's shown it, obviously, when he was down in St. Louis, that he had a good enough talent where he wanted to come back to Detroit where he could have a higher role, because he wasn't going to do anything behind
Yadier Molina in St. Louis. Yeah.
Molina. But I would, I'm right there with you, V. I'm missing myself some Gerald Laird, some G-Money, as Rod Allen would call him.
Rod Allen loved to call him. Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Never an expert hitter, great major league hitter on a consistent basis as a starter, for sure, you know, to say the least, as we saw the weaknesses of Laird at the plate when he was a starter with the Tigers before Avila came onto the scene. However, as a backup, you want a little bit more production than what Pena has given and what he has shown to produce and give ball clubs in the past for teams such as the Royals, who he was on for a large part of his career before the Tigers this season. And that's why I wonder why the Tigers didn't attempt to re-sign Laird a little bit more, knowing that he's gotten it done on winning ball clubs, and especially last year as a Tigers backup. He hit a ton of a lot better than Avila, honestly. Even though it wasn't a backup secondary role, Laird still got the job done when he was called upon to get the job done.
Yeah, Laird was a very, very solid backup catcher. And one guy that I'm looking up right now is Rob Brantley. If you recall him, he was in the Tigers organization as a catcher, and now he's in the Miami Marlins system.
Yep.
He's hitting .239 right now as a starting catcher down there in Miami. I understand that we let go of him for Omar Infante, and Omar's having a good year.
And Anibal Sanchez, who's been great so far.
Yeah, they've both been great, but I wish we could have kept Rob Brantley. I know he's only hitting .239, but he's a young kid. He's a lot younger than Avila himself. So that's who I'm checking out right now. And I also looked at Brian Holliday, who made his appearance for the Tigers a little bit last year. He's only hitting .231 down in Toledo right now. Not exactly the best numbers you could be looking for. So it looks like the Tigers are going to have to stick with what we got in Avila and Pena and just ride it out for as much as we possibly can. I mean, if worst comes to worst, what do you want to do? Throw Don Kelly back there?
Well, I mean, he plays every other position, right? And Leland loves him some Don Kelly.
Yeah, I'm a big Don Kelly fan, but I don't think he can catch enough. We're going to be struggling for options. That's all I got to say. Catching is not looking too hot right now for the Tigs.
Well, you know what? There's not a lot of mashers in the Tigers organization at catcher, and even with a guy like Rob Brantley, who knows how good he will be on a long-term basis as a catcher in the bigs. And he hasn't really shown much at the plate thus far in his major league career either, along with guys like Brian Holliday. And then you got a guy down in the farm system of the Tigers in Patrick Leland, the son of Jim Leland. But who knows what he will do, and that probably was just a draft pick made to accommodate and to satisfy Jim Leland and to make him feel good and everything. So you can't get an Alex Avila every day in the draft, you know, every single year in the MLB amateur draft that can come up and within a few years start producing and look relatively well at the plate and steady and confident like he had shown prior to, well, We saw it in 2011. So ever since then, after all those innings he caught, and I think the wear and tear on his knees and his legs from being in that position as catcher for almost the whole entire season, Kudla, in 2011, due to the fact that Vimar couldn't start at catcher, couldn't really spell Avila, because Vimar had those injury concerns and was worn down and everything. So Avila had that extra load of starts at the catcher position as a result of it. And I think the wear and tear caught up to him, and we haven't seen a good, productive Avila at the plate, realistically, since then, Kudla.
Yeah, Avila hasn't been the same, and I know he dealt with a couple little bit of knee injuries as well.
And he gets nicked up a lot of times, too, by foul balls, and I'll give him that much. And he still manages a good ball game, can throw out runners with the best of them, outside of guys like Yadier Molina and those type of catchers that are great defensive catchers. Thing is, that you're not going to get a catcher like that every single day as a major league ball club. Those guys aren't open on, you know, they're not out there to attain. Those guys are staying with their big league ball clubs because they can hit and defend and call a good game. Not many catchers can say that.
No, not very many catchers can call a good game, be very, very solid defensively and rake. You're just not going to find that. So Avila's going to do the job. I feel like hopefully he'll come around eventually, and we got to just stick with him. And that's one of those things that hopefully when the playoff time comes around, if the Tigers are there, he's peaking at the top form because realistically we are still very, very early on in the season.
And you think I think I'm more concerned. I think maybe other Tigers fans such as yourself, Kudla, are more concerned due to the fact that we saw Avila struggle at the plate all of last season as well. So it's not just early into this season in the first month of April that we've seen him struggle at the plate and not look very good up there. It was also last year, dating back to then. So it's been a large part of his career, dating back to everything post-2011. And honestly, post-2011 regular season, as we saw him struggle in the postseason of 2011 as well. So ever since then, like I said, so it's been a constant struggle for him at the plate, not just recently with his struggles in the first month of the season.
Yeah, I noticed all last year as well. However, I tend to dismiss a lot of that due to the lot of knee injuries and knee problems that he had. He was getting cortisone shots, I think it was almost every month, to try to keep his knees healthy, and that really affects you at the plate when you're trying to deal with a big knee problem and catching every day. So I tried to dismiss that and focus mainly on this year when he had the whole offseason to get healthy once again and is struggling at the plate, yeah, once again.
And I know he was too passive. That's what a lot of scouts and experts and fans said about him last season at the plate. But I think he's tried to address that. And we've seen him swing a little bit earlier in the counts thus far this season and still not the best results. And if it continues, that's when you really miss a guy like Gerald Laird. A guy that can get done a little bit more that spells him, which Pena really can't do.
Yeah, Pena's not the best backup catcher we've seen. And I feel like G-Money might, could we pull a trade off and try to get Laird again for a third straight seat or a third stint for the Tigers? Is that physically possible? And because I know the Atlanta Braves, they have a very good catcher in Gattis, I believe his
Who's
name is.
He's catcher. Yeah, because McCann's out right now. He'll be back soon. But Gattis, who can play a few positions, he hasn't been raking, but he's got some potential, especially for a backup catcher, which is what he will be in. I think he also plays in the outfield and left field, too. So he can do a few things for the Braves. So they're going to hang on to him, Kudla, which may make Gerald Laird available for a third stint with the Tigers. And that would be something.
I'll be interested to see if they just release Gerald Laird when Brian McCann gets back, because he will be their third-string catcher, and I'm almost positive that he will not want to be optioned down to AAA due to all his prior abilities, for that matter.
Yeah, he doesn't deserve that either, and he won't accept that assignment to the minor leagues, to AAA, for the Braves, because he's at the point of his career, he's a vet, and he's shown the ability to get it done as a backup in the major leagues and for competitive, successful ball clubs like the Tigers, like the Cardinals. So he deserves to get out of that situation if it does come to that for him with the Braves. And I think they will allow him to probably look for a potential suitor if that's the case for him with the Braves, Kudla.
Yeah, and I'm looking at Gerald Laird's numbers right now. He's played in 9 games, and he's hitting .333. Same old G-Money,
okay,
that's for sure.
Okay, yeah, doing it again. So Tigers or somebody else definitely should give him a shot if the Braves are going to bank on Gattis to be their backup going forward.
Yeah, if Gattis is their backup to Brian McCann, or they want to throw Gattis over at first base if Freddie Freeman struggles, they do have plenty of options to go with him. And it looks like Gerald Laird might be the odd man out, so welcome back to Detroit. Can I say that?
It'd be nice to say that, but it might be reaching a little bit to expect a third stint for him with the Tigers. Because think about it, wouldn't he have signed with the Tigers this offseason?
I
know
Dombrowski
probably didn't pursue him that heavily, but if he really wanted to stay here, don't you think Dombrowski and him could have worked something out to allow him to stay with the Tigers?
I would have hoped so.
Yeah.
I would have hoped so, but I think he might have left because he wanted to try to get a higher role and maybe get a couple starts. But when he signed with the Braves, that kind of all went out the window for me. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Gerald Laird, and that'll be a situation that I follow pretty closely.
Yeah, and I hope that the Tigers can attain his services if he does become available, because they could use a backup catcher, to say the least, Kudla. And I think
first
we both different. Agree on that.
Yeah, we need a backup catcher, and shoot, we may even need a starter.
Starter, yeah, sooner than later, which is a bad thing to say, but I think it might be the truth at this point, at least through the first month of the season. A little bit too early, too small of a sample size, but if we get the production that we got out of Avila last season in 2012, it will be a concern for the duration of this season as well. And then another guy, a catcher, a backup such as Laird, might have to be attained, or at least pursued. And I hope the Tigers do give that attempt to acquire somebody. If not Laird, somebody else who can spell Avila and produce a little bit more at the plate than what Pena has shown in his career in this season thus far with the Tigers.
Yeah, I'm trying to exceed the availability potentially of Russell Martin. I know he just signed over there at Pittsburgh, and they're not having the best
six,
season so far.
He's got six long balls already for the Pirates, too, so I don't see him going anywhere. And they've achieved a good amount of success throughout the first month of the season, too. So they're going to try to contend for a division title. So I don't see him going anywhere.
Yeah, he's just the first guy that comes up to my head whenever I think of a catcher as Russell Martin, just because of how great he is defensively, and any offensive options we get out of him would be a bonus. But
yeah.
I know Avila's a good defensive catcher, but whenever I think of the cream of the crop of the catching background, it is Yadier Molina and Russell Martin. Those two are the top two tiers in Major League Baseball.
And Martin really hasn't hit since his Dodger days. Was not a great hitter for the Yankees last season or the year before, but he gets it done with his defense, his game-calling ability, and throwing out runners like Yadier Molina. But honestly, Yadier Molina is in a field of his own. There's nobody else like Yadier Molina out there at the catcher position right now, in my honest opinion, Kudla.
No, there's nobody better than Yadier Molina. He's at the top of the class. He's the valedictorian of all the catchers. That's for absolute sure.
Definitely. There's no argument with that. Definitely.
Nope.
Now, the highlights and moments of the Tigers season for you so far, Kudla, have been what? Which have been the top ones from the month of April?
My number one highlight is Pena taking the lumber out in Seattle and holding on to the ball, getting the W in the fourth. And staying up to 1 in the morning to watch that game was definitely worth it.
So you stayed up to watch that one as well, then? I think we're both hardcore Tigers fans.
I don't miss a game, that's for sure. Even
now, how about some other ones for you, Kudla?
Last night's game was a big highlight for me. Seeing Prince Fielder hit the home run and just toss the bat as soon as he hit the ball. It was a line drive shot over the right field fence, and that was a big game for the Tigers. Going off the sweep of the Braves, that's another highlight, is the Braves series as a whole. Being able to sweep the red-hot Braves was enormous for the Tigers.
And they're dominating the Nats again. And they've had their number all season long, and even last year, I believe, as well. And the production out of Justin Upton has been dramatic, has been, you know, significant for the Braves. And if he keeps it up, along with Hudson, their starting pitchers, and Chris Medlin, Paul Mahalam, and the bullpen, the back end of their pen specifically, and those dominant late-inning arms of Craig Kimbrell and Johnny Ventures, they can dominate batters. And with that deadly, lethal combination in their rotation, in their bullpen, they have a true, legitimate shot at taking out the Nats for the division title this year. And
yeah,
getting McCain back, a good hitter, too, for the middle of their order, which will happen very soon, I believe.
Good hitter and pretty good defensive player as well. We could have just seen a little October preview with the Tigers-Braves series that we just witnessed. That is for sure.
Well, I think, honestly, Kudla, it's Nats or Braves right now from the NL. With both of their pretty dominant rotations, if Strasburg gets his act together, and now there's injury concerns with Strasburg, and he really hasn't shown durability in his major league career, including going deep into games. His endurance lacks something, and I think he's shown that this season for the Nats organization and their fans. And that's a concern for me, especially, Kudla, if I'm a Nats fan, and have high hopes for them, which they should possess as a ball club this year. With their talent, specifically those guys that get it done in the outfield, and Bryce Harper, Denard Span as well, good hitters in the middle of their order, along with Ryan Zimmerman, too, who you can't count out. Always, always a hard out. So they got the guys in that lineup, but also in that rotation of theirs with Strasburg, with Jordan Zimmerman, with Gio Gonzalez, who has not been as good thus far either for the Nats, Kudla.
Yeah, I had a chance to go down to a Nationals game last year when they took on the Mets, and they like to call it Natitude, and they were at an all-time high last year. I could only imagine this year, after getting Denard Span and having Strasburg come back, the expectations and the buzz around Washington, D.C. for the Nationals, and that race down there for the division between them and the Braves is going to be very, very intriguing itself. The Braves played some great, great baseball in the, I don't want to call it demise by any stretch, but the little stumble by Strasburg is very, very interesting to me to see, because just imagine what would have happened if they kept him going last year when he was hotter than a pistol, throwing 100-mile-an-hour fastballs, 90-mile-an-hour changeup, just mowing down hitters, and then they just shut him down.
He was a lot better last season before they shut him down than he does right now. It's early, small sample size, like we've both noted, but still, you might have to be a little bit concerned if you're the Nats.
I'm pausing for concern right now if I'm the Nationals, because I want to know where he's at mentally. The mental game of baseball, I hit on it every single time, is so big. And after he just got taken out last year in the middle of a race for a pennant, it shocks me that they did set him down. And I know it's the right decision maybe medically, but maybe could potentially mentally he's just not ready to come back completely into the role.
And he's only pitching 6 innings. I think he got to 7 one start this year. And he's never pitched 7 innings, I think, besides for the one outing that he had this year when he went 7. So he's not a guy that goes deep into ball games either, which you expect out of a dominant ace-caliber starting pitcher like Strasburg, Kudla.
Yeah, you expect 7-8. You expect Strasburg to be just like Justin Verlander.
At least give you 7.
That's what the expectation has been for years. Not years, but since he was drafted out of San Diego State, he would become Verlander or even better. That was the ceiling. And right now, I hate to say it, but he's almost falling on his face this season with all the lofty expectations. Blame that some on us, the media, for hyping him up for what we thought he would be. Maybe he needs time. Maybe he just doesn't have that ceiling that everyone expected out of him.
And it should be an intriguing division battle to watch all season long in the NL East between the Braves and the Nats. Now, who do you got taking it, though, in the NL East? I know it's early, but who would you say has the better long-term staying power atop the NL East, Nats or Braves? Braves have had the hotter start and have had the number of the Nats. So it would appear right now to be the Braves. But I think it's a little bit too early to judge and to give them the status of top dogs in the NL East, especially how they struggled against another top team in the Tigers over the weekend.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give the edge still for the Nationals just because of what they have as a whole unit. I feel like their whole team encompass is better than the ceiling that the Braves can handle. B.J. Upton really struggling for the Braves.
He does do that all the time. He's not consistent. And I don't think he'll ever be consistent at this point in his career, even though he's only 28, and Upton's even younger than that, Jay Upton. It's still good to have them both in the outfield defensively because they can cover a ton of ground along with Hayward and his bat. Thing is, though, B.J. Upton has been prone to K's all his career. So I think he's just showing what he is, Kudla, and I think they overpaid for him, and they're seeing that now.
Yeah, they definitely
But at least
overpaid.
They have the other Upton, too, who can rake and do it consistently.
Justin Upton's been absolutely raking this year. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And B.J. Upton's the one that's really holding the team back, in my personal opinion, hitting under 200, under the Mendoza line. That's why I'm going to go with the Nationals. I know it's an early sampling, and being able to see what the Nationals did last year and the way they got knocked out of the playoffs last year as well. That has to resonate in that locker room, and there is nothing more they want than to get back and take care of business when they do get to the playoffs. So that's why I got to give the driving force of adrenaline, anger, frustration, and just the ball club that they have to give the Nationals the edge in winning the division.
Well, how about Bryce Harper, who's kind of been overshadowed a bit, not a ton, by Justin Upton of the Braves. His great start to the season. And he's been raking home runs left and right thus far in the middle of that Nats order.
Yeah, Bryce Harper is one of my favorite players in Major League Baseball. I'm going to take the credit for him having a great season this year. Ever since I seemed to see him last year and talk to him.
It was because of you, right? Because you saw him, you met him one time last summer. Ever since then, right?
Ever since then, my little hitting knowledge that I gave to him from a crappy D3 baseball player to a professional that's 19 years old and can hit the crap out of the ball, I'm going to take it. But no, on a serious note, Bryce Harper's the real deal. And what he's done this season, his swing, so violent but so smooth at the same time, and just his raw speed and arm strength, his defensive ability out in the outfield, he's second to none. I would still take him over Mike Trout, and I said it all last year when Trout was getting all the hype. Just wait for Harper to come into his own, and it looks like he's really coming into his own and becoming an all-star for years and years and years.
And I think he definitely has shown that for Washington Nats fans.
Oh, yeah,
he has shown
sure.
that he's legit and will be a force for years to come, Kudla, in the middle of that Nats order. And
he's
aggressive and a fierce competitor, too, on top of it.
Yeah, he hates losing. I love seeing him. That highlight last year where he stole home off the Phillies, that
mm-hmm.
was my favorite moment of the whole regular season for the baseball year, was seeing Bryce Harper be able to steal home, and just the pure intensity and adrenaline and energy that he brings to the ball club is unparalleled. I know he's always going to be placed with Mike Trout, and that's one thing that's just naturally going to happen, but God, I love Bryce Harper and what he does for the Nationals ball club.
He's great, and he's fun to watch, to say the least, Kudla. So is Trout, but you know what? Everybody has their own opinion. You like Trout, or you like Harper better. I might like Trout a little bit better. And I think I like Trout a little bit more because I think he's a better defensive ball player. Can cover a ton of ground. I know Harper can, too. I just see Trout as more of the complete package. And I know I'm basing it off of last season, and you can't really be quick to judge based on one season, especially the rookie season of a ball player. But Trout was expected to have all this talent and all the intangibles, which he demonstrated on a consistent basis from day one last season for the Halos. And they were a different team because of him last year, once he came up. Now, they're struggling this year again like they did before he came up last year, but that's on their pitching because Trout has produced for the most part this year.
Yeah, and he has produced this year due to him gaining weight, gaining a little bit more power and everything along those lines. And one thing that I always bring back into consideration is the fact that Trout did come up during the season last year, so pitchers were never to get the full sample size and the full scouting report on Mike Trout. They only heard about him, and it's tough to look at film rather than see him in game action. And that's why this year I believe he started out a little slower. Yeah, he's picking up pace, but it's going to be interesting to see how they attack him because Bryce Harper was his first full season last year, and that might have led to a little bit of shaky times during the season, them picking up on the little things in his swing, little hitches, or pitches that they can get him out on. Like last year they attacked him a lot with outside pitches because he was so focused on just driving the ball, and that tended to have him pull the ball a lot. So he's been able to sit back and take the ball in all different sorts, all different directions of the field, left, right, and center. So he's coming to his own, and Trout, he's a great ball player as well. It's Coker Pesce to me. It's the same exact
thing. It's very close, right?
Yeah.
Very debatable.
Yeah, not much you can do. Either one of them, they're going to be all-stars for years, and they're probably one day going to both end up in Cooperstown. So it's like an Andrew Luck, RG3, Mike Trout,
yep.
Bryce Harper.
Definitely not much separation for the two guys. Both outfielders, too, surprisingly, in Harper and Mike Trout. Now, the Angels, as a whole entire ball club this year, I think have lacked the energy and the passion of Torii Hunter and the great clubhouse mentor and player on the field that he was for the Halos last season, defensively getting it done in right field, but also at the plate on a very high, consistent basis. His best season of all the years he has spent in the big leagues was last year with the Halos, when he got it done at a rapid rate, power-wise, too. And it kind of, a little bit came out of nowhere for Torii Hunter, but that wasn't the only effect he had on that ball club last year, too. Look at what he did mentoring Trout, molding him into the player that he's become, and that he showed off to Halos fans and to the MLB as an entire whole last season. And that has to be attested to and given some due credit to Torii Hunter, I believe, and the tutelage that he provided to Trout.
Yeah, the tutelage he provided to Trout was, it's got to be almost some parallel because of what a player Torii Hunter is, defensively and even offensively showing it. He's almost a career 300 hitter, I believe. He's
right around 300,
Career 280 hitter, so
yep.
Not too far off from 300, but all the gold gloves and defensive tips that you could learn from Torii Hunter had to have been great for Trout and learning his way from Torii Hunter. And bringing up Torii Hunter, this is one of my favorite topics to bring up, of Torii Hunter, is the Angels went out, and they made a big splash in free agency. If you remember this guy named Josh Hamilton, they spent a little bit of money on him, right? Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. They spent a little bit lavishly. You know, not too much, though.
Oh, not over $100 million. Nothing crazy.
But they opened up the checkbook just a tad.
Yeah, you look at the right fielder for the Detroit Tigers and the right fielder for the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, and Torii Hunter's hitting .370 with $100 million man Josh Hamilton is hitting a robust .204 on the year.
Oh, great. Yeah, just above the Mendoza line. Good for Joshy. He was worth all that money. And, you know, he showed it. He showed off those tremendous skills at the plate last season down the stretch for the Rangers, too, right? But he was great for them down the stretch. He did everything they wanted. And that's why the Rangers fans loved him. They adored him, and they showed it off to him when he came back for his homecoming this season as a member of the rival Halos. I'm being sarcastic, by the way, too. But that was
a joke
of a signing, Kula.
Josh Hamilton. Been an absolute joke. I'm trying to find out how many strikeouts they have, but it turns out that you can't even count as high as how many strikeouts as Josh Hamilton has already on this year because it's been that dreadful. That's just how great it is to be a Tigers fan right now, looking over at the Halos, all the hype from ESPN and all the major markets on the Halos. Well, they got Pujols, they got Trumbo, they got Hamilton. It's the most dotted lineup in the world. And then Torii Hunter comes over to Detroit, and he's just hitting .370. I mean, no big deal.
And a great two-hole hitter. Everything you expect out of a two-hole hitter, and then some, he has provided to the Tigers this season. Hamilton, nothing near that, Kudla, because he swings and misses, is prone to the K far too often. And he showed that last year with the Rangers after the great start he had. He had that four-home run game against the Orioles. But you know what? Not much. I wouldn't say it was that. What am I trying to say here? It wasn't that far after that point where I think he started to struggle a bit, and he showed where he wasn't that good of a contact hitter. He really was not after that point. Kaying in a lot. He was doing that a lot. And showed up some very bad plate discipline, too, swinging at tons of pitches out of the zone and in the zone. So showing off some bad traits, and he's carried that over to the Halos now, Kudla. And they're going to regret that signing because of it. And also because of the mental mishaps he has sometimes, reverting back to his alcohol addiction from way back. And he still has those tendencies, I think, to revert back to his old ways and to wander off the right path that he should be on. And that's the scary thing, too, for me going forward, along with his age and his lack in production at the plate that we showed or that we saw him show in the second half of last season with the Rangers. A major reason why they weren't willing to lend him all that money in the offseason that the Halos gave out to him, when they could have just had Torii Hunter for little
money. Torii Hunter has been everything you can imagine, and that's the reason why I would have never, ever, ever opened up the checkbook for Josh Hamilton like that. All of his past that he has, you're putting him out in California, which is a area where there's a lot of interesting things going on where he could fall back in those traps.
Oh, yeah, easily.
And the way he's been swinging the bat, you could have taken notes off the playoffs last year to notice that you shouldn't open the checkbook on him like that. I just am very, very flustered and confused on how he got such a big contract. But nonetheless, it takes out a big, big opponent of the Detroit Tigers in the American League out of the playoff race. And everything you could imagine, throwing up Josh Hamilton in the 3 or 4 hole, it's almost irrelevant having him in the lineup because he's been such a liability.
Yep, and he was a major choke artist, like you said, down the stretch for the Rangers. And dropping easy fly balls, cans of corn, too, in the outfield for the Rangers, as he did against the A's, which allowed the A's to win the division at the very end of last season. So he did not show up, and he showed this lack of plate discipline, starting in the second half of last season for the Rangers. So the Halos should have known that signing him, before they gave out that big contract, the big money to him, they should have known that his plate skills were declining.
His plate skills have looked like they have been declining for the past 2 years. When he gets into the postseason, if you remember when they made their run to the World Series, it was Nelson Cruz that put the team on his back, belting all the home runs left and right. Josh Hamilton struggled again 2 years ago in the playoffs. You've seen that on a consistent basis. When he gets in a big situation, he just tries to do too much, and he's unable to contribute. Because of his past, he had success hitting the fastball and hitting it out of the ballpark. So now when he sees a fastball, whether it be up in the zone or out of the zone, he feels that he's going to be able to get on top of it and absolutely smoke it.
Mm-hmm.
When mentally, he's lacking. His skills have declined just that little bit where his swing doesn't let him get back on that fastball and drive it down the left field line or right field line for himself. That's one of those things that it's going to be a rough contract for him because he's expected a lot, and I can't see him picking it up that fast.
Well, they're on the books for 10 years. It's more than a multi-year contract. It's going to be into his late 30s when his plate skills, his plate discipline, and his bat speed might be entirely diminished, might be nowhere near where it is right now, and it's already started to show signs of decline. And the bat speed, like I said, has been the major factor. It's just not the same. So when he's reaching out for those pitches on the outside corners, out of the zone, he's swinging and missing. And he does it far too often to be a reliable, productive number 3 or 4 hitters for the Halos. And for a team that wants to compete for not only division titles, Kudla, but as you know, World Series titles. And that's why Artie Moreno opened up the checkbook when he simply could have had Torii Hunter for 2 years at, I believe, how much did he get this offseason from the Tigers?
Torii Hunter? I'm not exactly sure what his
contract, 2 years at $26 million total, so it's $13 million a year. And they gave out $20-plus million a year to Josh Hamilton over the course of 10 years, or right around there. A ludicrous contract. And now, you know what? They're not going to reap the benefits of it. They're going to have to pay for it over the long term. And they're going to regret it big time, along with the signing of Pujols, who is still good.
Pujols is another signing I questioned. Another signing
old.
I questioned Pujols.
Yeah, I agree.
How about
C.J. Wilson? C.J. Wilson is not a top-line starting pitcher.
No, C.J. Wilson had, what was it, one good year, and they opened up the checkbook for him as well, and that's going to – they're in a whole lot of debt over there in Los Angeles looking at the way that they're handling their organization. Pujols opened up the checkbook for him. What, he get a 12-year deal, something like that? I can't
another 10-year something deal,
I can't expect him to produce for that long, and that's one thing. I mean, Pujols is a great player, so his contract will do them justice. He's just a great baseball player. And him and Cabrera are pretty much the same type hitters. They're one of those guys that they're not going to let down.
Mm-hmm.
But the money that they offered Pujols for a guy that is beast, like, I mean, he's a good defensive player. He's one of the best in the game, but last year he struggled, and this year I'm not sure where his numbers are at, but it's another thing just to keep your eye on. When people struggle, the magnifying glass will be on your organization, and that's what's going on right now with C.J. Wilson, Josh Hamilton, and even Pujols under the microscope just a little bit.
And Pujols had a horrible start to last season. He didn't homer until sometime in May. Now, he's homered a few times already this year, so not as bad of a start. But still, that slow, weak start, I think, showed signs of the decline that Pujols is on as well as an older ball player now. He's still a smart player, though, a pure baseball hitter who can hit for average, also spray the baseball all over the field to all parts of the outfield. And he gets it done for the most part offensively. Still does at this point in his career. But the thing is, they signed him to a major 10- or 12-year deal, which will extend Pujols into his upper 30s and early 40s even possibly with the Halos, when he won't be worth the amount of that contract that he's being paid on an annual basis. And that's when it's going to look really bad for the Halos. As right now, they could still contend maybe to get better starting pitching. And with him still relatively young, not young, but still in the prime years of his career, where he can still have a good 2 to 3 year stretch after this season. But counting on him after that, Kudla, I think it's a far stretch. It's something that I would not want to do and want to be depending on after the next 2 to 3 years of his contract.
8 to 9 years from now, do I think Pujols is going to be the same baseball player worth $20 million a year? No way, not a chance. And that's one thing that I believe that there's something in L.A., something in the water, something out there in California where they just don't think straight. I don't know what it is.
Well, I think Artie Moreno felt the need to spend because he saw the Dodgers and new ownership of Magic Johnson taking over, and he knew that they would start spending big money and start competing for baseball fans. And the Dodgers naturally already have the bigger baseball market, have more of the rich tradition and success as a baseball franchise. So they garner the attention before the Halos do from their fans. So I think he felt the need to compete with Dodger Blue, Kudla, and felt like that he could outspend a bunch of other bigger market ball clubs like the Tigers, Bo Sox, Yankees, Cubs, teams like that, and garner success right away through doing that like the Yanks have done in the past, even the Bo Sox to a degree. And it's failed miserably so far for Artie Moreno and the Halos. And it's not because of their hitters and that lineup of theirs. So I wouldn't blame it on the additions of Pujols and Hamilton that much. For the most part, in my opinion, it's on their starting pitching and their lack of quality arms at the top of the rotation. Outside of Jared Weaver, who's on the shelf right now with an injury, I believe an elbow injury, which could affect his effectiveness going forward in his career, there's not a lot of reliable guys in their rotation overall, including the likes of C.J. Wilson, who I wouldn't count on as my number two or number three, like the Halos are largely counting on him to perform.
Yes. Looking at the starts that Weaver had earlier on in the season, his numbers were elevated, to say the least. His elbow was affecting him, and it's one of those things where his velocity was down from a point where he didn't throw hard in the first place when he would top out at his fastball.
No, he's not a hard thrower anyways.
Yeah, and when you lose the lack of velocity that you have and you turn into a Greg Maddux type figure, I just don't think that his stuff is near as good to be at the point of Greg Maddux where you can throw 85 and get away with it and still be a perennial all-star. I'm very, very concerned for Jared Weaver. I think he's a great pitcher, puts his heart and soul into baseball, and it's one of those guys that I would hate to go against, but I'd love to have him on my team. And it's one of those, I'm nervous for him with this elbow injury because his stuff looked like it was declining a little bit at a very young age, something that we've
seen. He's still young.
He's still very young, and it's something that we saw in his brother, Jeff Weaver, who had a couple good years, and then everything started spiraling and going downhill, and I just really hope that does not happen to Jared.
Yeah, Jeff wasn't the same after a while of good, productive years with the Tigers, and even after that, a little bit with the Yankees a little bit, not for very long, though, because the Yankees got him in that deal in which the Tigers acquired the likes of Jeremy Bonner and Carlos Pena from the A's. It was a three-team deal. And Ted Lilly was also involved. But Weaver was not very good after that. A little bit with the Cardinals in 06 against the Tigers in the World Series. That was kind of his coming out party on the national stage. But he was still not the most reliable at that point. He was more of a number three, number four, a guy that kind of came out of nowhere onto the scene at that point as his best years were kind of already behind him. Thing is, Jared Weaver's more stuff. More dominant stuff. Not with velocity, per se, as he doesn't throw hard and didn't already before the injury, like you said, Kudla. And after him in the Halos rotation, who is there to rely on that you can count on to take
Nobody.
Maybe some of the starts for Weaver, to be that effective number two behind Weaver at the top of the Halos rotation? Because I wouldn't count on Vargas. I wouldn't count on Joe Blanton either, for sure. You know, soft throwers that maybe aren't in the primes of their career, including Tommy Hansen, too, who's lost a ton of velocity on his fastball and is no longer that great young starting pitcher that he was dating back a few years ago now with the Braves. And that's why the Angels kind of got him for a tad cheaper than maybe he would have gone for if a team was trying to trade for him 2 seasons or 3 seasons ago. And now these guys are back out of the rotation, guys. They're not reliable frontline starters. And to be a highly competitive ball club that wants to win it all potentially, don't you have to have somebody else besides for Jared Weaver at the top of your rotation that can get it done and be dominant, be, you know, truly reliable number two, effective frontline caliber starting pitcher? C.J. Wilson does not do that enough to satisfy what I think the Halos need behind Jared Weaver, Kudla. And Vargas, Hanson, and Blanton don't do that as well.
Hitting wins games, but pitching wins championships. And the Angels just don't have enough pitching, in my personal opinion, for that whatsoever. And that's what the Tigers found out very quickly after making it in the playoffs with the bats. And the arms kind of fell off the table in 2006, if you remember the World Series. And that's when Verlander rose. We get Pfister, who's a very, very, very good pitcher under the radar, along with Scherzer, a big strikeout guy. And guys coming out of the bullpen at the time, we had a decent bullpen. Now, not so much, but you could still count on Al Albuquerque in the pen. And even Phil Koch stepped up last year during the playoffs to pitch well. Pitching is what's going to get it done. That is for sure. You look at Kane, Lincecum, and Bumgarner last year. Those guys came to play in the World Series, and that's what made the Giants take it home. So pitching is what's going to win the championship. And in order to bring the World Series, you're going to need something, and I can't see it with Blanton, Wilson, and Vargas.
The starting pitching of the Tigers is definitely the edge they have on teams like the Halos, the Blue Jays, the Yankees, and even the Bo Sox this year. Now, there's also the A's who are good starting pitching-wise, the Rangers who are decent, but the Tigers definitely have the edge on the Rangers as well. And I would say, in terms of experience, and probably top of the rotation guys, a better overall starting pitching staff than the A's, too, who are still very young. So that's their biggest advantage over all these other American League ball clubs. Their weakness, though, still, on a large part, has to be their bullpen, especially the back of their bullpen arms, and specifically in the ninth inning. Who's going to get it done in the closer role on a consistent basis going forward? Is it Papa Grande? Is it Al? And who of these guys can stay healthy also? And when you look at the Halos, a team like them, it's not just their starting pitching that's weak. It's also their bullpen, Kudla. At least for us, we have the starters who can go 7 innings, 8 innings, K, 8, 9, 10 guys. And realistically, our 1 through 4 can all do that, all have the endurance to go deep into ball games and to dominate on occasion, if not consistently, Kudla.
Tigers have the advantage in that aspect. And I looked at the Angels bullpen. I couldn't name three of those guys off the top of my head. And I would like to consider myself a baseball aficionado. And unable to do that, that's interesting and almost mind-boggling for myself.
Well, they have Ernesto Fieri, who closed games for them down the stretch in the second half of last season after they acquired him from the Padres, a hard-throwing relief pitcher. But, you know, there's no more Rodney in that pen. I believe they had to trade Jordan Walden to get Tommy Hansen from the Braves, so there's no more Jordan Walden either as an option at the back end of their pen. And it's a week after Fieri, and he's young. So I don't know how much you can count on him to get it done every single game as a ninth inning guy. So that definitely is a concern and the major weakness for the Halos, even worse than their starting pitching staff.
Major, major concern with their bullpen, and obviously the starting pitching is trouble, but not near as much as the bullpen itself. And we touched on the bullpen, and one of the bullpens that's really came out this year and been red hot has been the Boston Red Sox with Joel Hanrahan, even one former Tiger great, Andrew Miller, minus the whole great part.
And Koji Uehara as the closer for the Bo Sox thus far, with Hanrahan out, who's now back off the DL. So they're kind of stacked at the back end of games.
That's a bullpen that's going to be hard to reckon with, and especially with what they're doing. They're tearing up the majors right now, one of the best teams in the business, and I guess they just needed to get Bobby V out or something like that.
Well, I mean, look at their starting pitching staff with the same names, too, in their rotation in Lester and Buchholz. Very good outings out of all those guys, including a guy like Lackey in his last start, his first off the DL, because he had the Tommy John surgery, was out all of last season, and then an injury reoccurred for him, I believe, with maybe his throwing arm, but he was out for a bit at the start of this season, came back, had a very good first outing off of the DL. And that guy, Lackey, has not been very good since a while now, since his days with the Halos. And that's dating back to what? Before 2011 and maybe before 2010. That's the last time when he was a guy you could count on. And maybe if he regains his form a little bit, along with Lester and Buchholz at the top of the rotation, Kudla, they might have enough bats in their order to get it done and contend for a division title. And who would have thunk that after the year they had last season, finishing in the cellar, the very bottom of the AL East? It was a disaster all year long. They traded away guys like Beckett, Adrian Gonzalez, and Carl Crawford, clearing the books. And in the offseason, signed a lot of good veteran guys for the clubhouse, but guys that were kind of washed up in their careers, like Ryan Dempster, who I forgot to name, who's been consistent and reliable so far for the Bo Sox in their rotation. And he stunk it up for the Rangers last season in the second half after they acquired him from the Cubbies. So these guys are kind of reemerging onto the scene and doing it out of nowhere after being down and out in their careers.
Yeah, one of the signings they had, Mike Napoli, came over from Texas. Not much expected out of him. He's already racked up 27 RBIs on the year with four bombs, and he's even got a triple. Mike Napoli has a triple on the year. But it's one of those things that if you can catch lightning in the bottle, which it seems like they might just have done with the signing of Napoli and Johnny Gomes playing some good baseball. Johnny Gomes hasn't played good baseball in 5 years, and now he's out there just playing some great ball out there in Boston. So they caught lightning in a bottle, and they're running with it. Another thing, Will Middlebrook's coming in for Euclid as he departed ways last year. And it's one of those things that Boston looks like they're doing a good job going after John Farrell to be the manager, a former Red Sox man himself. Just everything seems to be going right, and it's good for the city of Boston. They need some good baseball to hang their hat on right now.
And Farrell was the former pitching coach under Francona when the Bo Sox won World Series titles in both 04 and in 07. Then he went over to the division rival Toronto Blue Jays to be their manager for a few seasons. And actually, they tried to lure him away from the Blue Jays last season before they hired Bobby V. However, the Blue Jays refused to give the Red Sox permission to interview Farrell for the position, which was open after they got rid of and dismissed Terry Francona. So it seems like the chemistry in the clubhouse is back to being where it should be for the Bo Sox. And it's been a large factor for why they have had such a resurgence this season and have 17 wins in the month of April and have been, the best team in all of baseball and for sure in the AL this season and look like legit contenders if they keep it up.
Yeah, no one would have thought that. That's for sure after seeing last season what the Orioles did and the offseason that the Blue Jays had going out and trying to stack a all-star team up there north of the border, and they're kind of falling on their face.
Like it's the Miami Marlins last year when they tried it themselves with the same kind of players in Jose Reyes, Josh Johnson, Mark Burley, who I believe are all guys that maybe aren't totally injury-prone outside of Jose Reyes, but might be on the wrong side of their careers too, including Johnson and Burley for the rotation, along with R.A. Dickey, the NL Cy Young Award winner from last season who they acquired in the offseason, and had to give up a very talented catcher to do so in the process, Kudla, which might hurt them in the long term, especially seeing how bad they have struggled thus far this season.
Yeah, it's one of those things I would have never trusted R.A. Dickey, remembering him from his days in Texas when he first started out throwing the knuckleball, and I remember the Tigers put up a 14 spot on him or something outrageous like that.
Yep, in Texas, before he was a knuckleball pitcher, though. And I believe Oral Hershiser taught him to throw the knuckle or recommended it to him, and that's when he learned how to. And ever since then, he's been a gradually better pitcher. And then last season, he was great for the Mets. But, I mean, realistically, like I think you're trying to infer right now and imply, can he really be a dominant starting pitcher, especially in the AL East? I don't think so, Kudla.
In the AL East and in the American League as a whole, when you have to go up against a designated hitter instead of a pitcher, that makes the world of a difference as a starting pitcher. And when you're throwing knuckleballs up to a guy that you want to say, okay, let's throw Prince Fielder as a DH today, you're going to throw him seeing knuckleballs. If you float one, that thing's going to be in the 35th row in the second deck. It's one of those things that
he's going to kill it.
Facing those hitters, it's not like you're going up against Tim Lincecum in the box or something like that. That's a big out. That's a very big out. You only get 27, and when you can get an extra bat like what the Tigers have or any designated hitter in the American League, David Ortiz, stuff like that.
And Big Poppy's been rapidly hot to start this season. A huge hitting streak. He went deep last night, and he's been great like none other. And I don't think he's going anywhere, Big Poppy. And
no,
what a great franchise icon, too, he is now. And that great speech, motivational speech he made after the Boston Marathon bombings at Fenway Park on a Saturday afternoon. He had a few choice words, but it definitely fired up the crowd. And they've been a great ball club. And that city is definitely riding on their success right now, Kudla, to get through that disaster which occurred in Boston, tragically, a few weeks ago now at the Boston
Marathon.
Yeah,
one of those things that's just a good uplifting story for the whole city of Boston, having the Red Sox where they're at and David Ortiz where he's at. And that just speaks volumes as we were discussing the difference between American or National League teams and the whole designated hitter ordeal. David Ortiz, the DH, he's hitting .500 on the year with 3 home runs already.
Yep.
That's what you get out of a pure hitter when you have.
And he just returned from the DL, and the guy's already raking like none other.
Yeah,
and I think, you know what, you just can't deny Big Poppy and how good of a hitter he is. He's not going anywhere, like I said.
No, one of the best the game's seen in a long time, and it's good to see him get back because there's a lot of discussion about him being done and not being able to hit anymore, wrist problems whatsoever, and he comes out this year and is absolutely just crushing the ball.
And how about some of the Yankees hitters this year who we thought were done and washed up, like Vernon Wells, Travis Hafner, big home run numbers out of them already. Where have they come from?
It's Yankee Stadium, and gosh, I can't even begin
that
to
that right field porch, man.
You
how easy is it to hit one out there? I think you maybe could go deep, Kudla.
I would go deep for sure. There's no doubt about it that I'd go yard at Yankee Stadium. Gosh, it just makes me so upset you'd put Travis Hafner. And that's why the trade that we made.
Nothing with the Indians in recent memory.
Nothing. And he gets to Yankee Stadium, and it's 3:14 down the right field line. He has to pop up to second base, and it's gone with the jet winds that are going out at Yankee Stadium. That's one thing that always swayed everyone's view on the Granderson and Jackson trade was Granderson's home run numbers. Well, he's playing at a wiffle ball field, for
They're
God's
inflated.
Sake. No wonder he's hitting a home run.
Like you said, a pop-up blows out. It's so easy for a major league hitter to hit one deep. If you have any kind of pop in your bat, you can hit one deep out to right field. And Granderson has been extremely successful in large part because of it, Kudla. And I think we both realize that.
Let's just
and
now
he's hurt. Along with a lot of those other big-time hitters for them.
Yeah, Granderson's out, and that's bad for the Yankees. But let's play a role reversal right now. Let's give the Yankees Comerica Park, and let's put Prince Fielder and Miguel Cabrera playing at Yankee Stadium as their home field. Could you
They're
imagine
hitting
40
bombs
home
a year easily.
They'd be
the two
hitting
of them.
50 bombs a year if they played in that field. It would be outrageous. So with the wind and playing in a 3:14 down the line, come on now. It's just one of those things that I don't know. I'm not a Yankee fan, and I never will claim to be. Only one player that I'll ever appreciate from the New York Yankees is Derek Jeter because he's a consummate professional. But other than that, not a fan. And it's tough to give me credit or love to Hafner just purely based off the fact of him playing at a wiffle ball field.
And the Yanks are staying afloat, surprisingly, because of that right field porch and their home run hitters who have taken advantage of that short right field porch at Yankee Stadium. And Tigers playing in Yankee Stadium would have big power numbers out of not only Fielder and Cabrera, but perhaps even Austin Jackson, Torrey Hunter. And you know what? Our pitchers would fare a lot better, too, honestly, because we K batters. Example, Anibal Sanchez, 17 Ks. I mean, he's done it. Scherzer and Verlander have also struck out 14 batters in their career. And Fister can get up to 10, maybe 11, around that number, too, on a very good day. So our guys can make batters miss. And that's the key to success as a pitcher at Yankee Stadium.
That's a big key to success there at Yankee Stadium is throwing up the K's and doing what you can. And that's one thing that I always appreciate out of this Tigers staff is their ability to make guys look stupid. I mean, I hate sorry for that language, but, I mean, shoot, you look at Max Scherzer. Holy crap. He throws his circle change, and that looks dives down and in on the right-handed hitters, and they just have no chance. And you look at Verlander, obviously, he makes guys look dumb every single time he goes out with the curveball he throws. And it's one of those things, sometimes you just got to sit back and look at it and just take it in because there's not too many pitchers with the stuff like the Tigers have.
Of our 1-4, too, like you said, it's not just Verlander or Scherzer. It's now also Sanchez, who has shown it really all season long thus far, besides for maybe today, and then even Fister. But Kudla, we got to move on because we got a guest joining us now on the show, and former Eastern Michigan University fullback Matt Boyd Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's up, man? How's it going?
Very good. Sorry about keeping you on the line waiting there. We had a pretty good lively debate and discussion going on the MLB and the Detroit Tigers, so sorry about that, though. Hey. Now we're going to move on from baseball, talk more about something maybe you're interested in, Matt Boyd, talking about the NFL draft. Now, I know you went undrafted, and you expected that, though. Now, what's been the process? What has it been like since the draft, though, took place and since it concluded on Saturday for you specifically?
Well, it's normally a period of about 3 days after the draft where people who go undrafted would get the call from, you know, their respective organizations who want to pick them up in the free agent camp. Me, I was expecting to hear a call back from the Lions. I did get a call about a couple of days after the draft, after speaking with my agent. You know, we heard very positive things, but it happened to be so that they ended up taking somebody, and I believe it was the sixth or seventh round, ended up taking a pretty good gifted athlete to play the similar position that I was supposed to play. It really just, you know, kind of ended that opportunity.
Was it disappointing to find out, Matt, when you thought that you were going to get a call that said you were going to be signed by the Lions?
Yeah, you know, it was disappointing. You know, I was always, you know, trying to, you know, look at the positive side, look at the bright side. But, of course, you know, your heart can't help but sink when you want to get that call telling you that. And, you know, it definitely did disappoint me a little bit. My agent also told me that they keep guys on call just in case, you know, someone were to get hurt or someone were to get injured. They got a list of guys who they can bring in the training camp or in the rookie camp, you know, depending on the situation. And I could potentially be one of those guys called, but that's all, you know, no one can control that, whether, you know, you really don't want anyone to get hurt, but, you know, you'd rather just be selected. But of course, at the end, you know, things do happen. You know.
So Matt, what remains for you going forward with your football career?
Well, going forward,
and if not the NFL, do you see yourself latching on with another professional football league such as the CFL or the UFL, if that's still even around? But talk about that a little bit.
Right, yeah, I do plan to. Yeah, I'm not sure if the UFL is around either. But as far as the CFL is concerned, I definitely do want to go explore my options there and see, you know, just see where it takes me. You know, I don't feel like I'm done with football, you know, as of yet, and I know the CFL, you know, is a great organization and a great league, you know, and I'd be blessed to be able to get an opportunity to continue my career there as well. And, you know, who knows, maybe eventually that, you know, a decent career there may, you know, spawn into another opportunity to play in the NFL.
And, Matt, let's bring my co-host into the discussion now. I'm Brennan Kudla, the voice of Alma College Hoops, and he played baseball, had to deal with teammates, and you have as well in football locker rooms. So I want to now bring up a major topic of discussion the past few days in the coming out of Jason Collins, the first active pro athlete from the four major professional sports to come out and to proclaim as being a gay male, being a gay man and playing a professional sport, dealing with teammates in the locker room scene. Now, for you, Matt, how awkward would that perhaps be dealing with a player, a teammate that is homosexual? And how would you react? How do you think your teammates would adjust to that and accommodate that player if the situation arose?
Right. You know, it's really hard to, you know, predict, you know, how someone will respond because, you know, everyone, you know, of course, has different opinions and views. It's really, you know, it goes without saying a lot of times what I guess, because, of course, you're sure there's some homosexuality going on somewhere in some locker rooms, but it's really not spoken, just like it is in the NBA, NFL, and you know, and baseball and any other sports league. But I think it was, you know, very brave, you know, because like you said, everyone else now in the locker room is, you know, looking at him in possibly, you know, a different light. You know, but it's hard to, you know, exactly put my finger on how, you know, everyone would respond to someone, you know, coming out and just, you know, being out of the closet or whatever term you want to, you know,
mm-hmm.
put behind, you know.
And Kudla, how do you think a baseball player would react to a teammate coming out as gay?
Personally, I don't think I would be able to speak for everybody as a whole, but as myself in a baseball locker room or just on the field in general, I think it's one of those things where you majority just keep to yourself, because there isn't that much of a locker room presence in baseball as there is in a sport like football or basketball. So for baseball itself, I believe you just accept what happened or accept him coming out and respect him for the courage that it took for him to be able to come out to everybody that, for the most part, you would assume is straight and not understand what that lifestyle is. But you have to respect him and respect the courage that it takes for a man to be able to stand up and say, this is a lifestyle that I live, and I hope you the guys accept that I would do such a thing and live my life the way I would like it to be. So maybe just accept it for what it is. And if you do feel distant from it or don't want to be a part of the situation, just try to keep yourself as reserved as possible so you don't cause any stirs in the locker room, because that could disrupt the whole team.
Now, Kudla, you're a pretty devout Christian. I am myself. I don't know about Matt, but
yes,
knowing your... What was that, Matt?
I said, yeah, I am.
So all of us on this radio show right now are Christians, and Brendan Kudla, with your beliefs as a Christian, what did you think of the stance that Chris Broussard took as a fellow Christian, coming out pretty harshly against Jason Collins and his announcement? What do you think of that?
As a Christian, Catholic, very, very devout to the church, I agreed with most of what Chris Broussard said. However, I would not have went to that extent. I believe to a point that there are issues where you have to let them live their life and be happy in whatever way it is. So I agreed with some of the things that Chris Broussard said, but I believe some of it also was a little bit too harsh and just should not have been said to the media, something maybe he should have kept into himself.
Matt, what are your thoughts on what Chris Broussard said? He kind of came out very harshly against Jason Collins and his announcement of being gay, taking the stance that it's not accepted in the Bible, and thus, as Christians, we should not accept that as well.
Right. Now, first I'd like to say that I think it was, you know, actually, you know, really just as big on him to really put his views out there, knowing that you could be shunned in today's society if you're not supportive of that lifestyle. People may even look at you different, you know, not to take anything away from Jason Collins. But the majority of what he said, I'd have kept it to myself. I do agree with what he was saying as a Christian, you know, but I think it was, you know, kind of big that he put that out there, as he did. You know, it was real. He really didn't hold anything back. But at the bottom line, you know, the majority of what he's saying, I believe it did have, you know, some truth and some merit to it. And then, and I agree with, you know, the majority of it.
Now, Matt, do you think the lifestyle of homosexuality will be accepted by an NFL player in the near future? And as a result, that player will come out in the very near future and claim that he is also a homosexual male athlete and subsequently deals with all the locker room issues that may arise from it.
Yeah, it's really hard to say, but I doubt it. I believe, like, maybe in a football presence, it's more like, you know, just don't ask, don't tell. You know,
mm-hmm.
regardless of whether people have suspicions or something, you know, unless you're walking around the locker room flaunting, you know, your sexuality and, you know, different people, you know, and different things like that, it just shouldn't be like we're all there to play football at the end of the day. If you're not, you know, whatever is not can be potential distraction to help us, you know, win a championship, that should be kept at home. So regardless if it's religious views, you know, views about anything controversial, you know, abortion, you know, your sexuality, anything, I think it should be, you know, kept to yourself, because all that is at the end of the day is distractions. So
yep.
Whether or not an NFL player would come out, you know, I doubt it. I doubt it. If he does, you know, that's, you know, then, you know, big ups to him. And, you know, I see he's trying to do things, you know, for the gay community as well. And I, You know, I support anybody who's willing to fight for what they believe in. But as a Christian, I just don't believe that, you know, that that's a battle that you should be trying to fight.
So regardless if you're straight, gay, or bisexual, you're saying all that matters as a professional athlete is whether or not you produce when you get on the field, in your role as a football player, on your respective football team, baseball team, hockey team, whatever sport you may play. It's about producing results and helping your team win games and win championships. You don't want to deal with all that extra stuff that goes on outside of the locker room and off the field, is what you're trying to say. You want to keep that out of the locker room.
Right. If I was one of Jason Collins' teammates, I would, you know, be a little perturbed that now all of a sudden I'm going to be harassed by the media about how I feel about him, and whether or not I may have known it or may not have known it, I'd have just, you know, I'd have rather had it so that regardless, you know, we get out, and if he can help me to win a championship, then I have no problem with it. I could play side by side with someone on the football field, work out with them every day, you know, and as long as I know that we have a mutual goal in common, and that's to win the championship and to win games, you know. But once other things come into play, now it's all, you know, about how do you feel about, you know, me, my sexuality, or and this, that, and the third, you know. Then that's when, you know, it can be distracting. But yeah, like you say, you know, that you just want to win, and if it's not helping you to win, then it can hurt you from winning.
Completely agree with that statement by Matt right there. For sure, that's what you came to the sport to go do, is win championships, whether it be in college. Matt, yourself playing in the MAC conference, you came there to win a MAC championship or do the best you can. And all other aspects aside, with classes and stuff like that, when you're on that football field, it's to win. And I found it very interesting that Jason Collins picked a period where he was becoming a free agent to make
and
this
may his career be winding down. May his professional basketball career be over with after this season? And it seems like it might be, right? As a career bench and role player, you know, has his time ended in the NBA?
So, now surfacing around Jason Collins when he goes out to try to get signed as a free agent, I feel like it's almost one of those things that he might not get signed because of the media, the potential of the media all around the organization,
mm-hmm.
Swaying the focus from winning a championship into playing with a gay athlete. And don't get me wrong, like, if you play, it's completely okay. Play, win a championship. But shifting the whole locker room mentality from not winning, from going to be playing with Jason Collins, how does it feel to be playing with the first active gay player, rather than I'm out here to win games, and that's how I make money, is by getting my team to win games. That's my job. That's my profession. And that's what I need to do to support my family. So it's one of those
big...
Is it
a good PR move, though? For the team that does sign him this offseason, if he indeed continues playing in the association, don't you think that's a good PR move? Because it makes the team look good for accepting a gay athlete into their locker room and being the first team to do so in professional sports, the four major professional sports.
How is he going to fit into the locker room, though, is my aspect that I would like
to
know, because there's going to be players that are uncomfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Matt, what do you think about it?
But as far as PR concerned, it definitely would be a good move. You definitely get support from the gay community. But if I was the owner of the team, I would look deeper within, you know, the external environment of my team. How do people look at my organization from the outside looking in, and then look internally and see what, you know, how are people affected by this move? If I bring in Jason Collins, how would, you know, the coach feel, the players feel, you know, what would I do? You know, how would they interact with the media? How would this affect practice? Would this affect, you know, any way how they play? Because, yeah, I mean, you may sell more tickets. You might get a little bit more publicity or something like that. But, you know, it's like really what's more important, you know, selling tickets or winning games. If not saying that directly anybody who signs Jason Collins would not be as successful, but it's going to be some, like, you know, it's undoubtedly, there's no way you can deny that there's going to be distractions on that whenever team signs him, if a team does sign.
And Matt, do you believe that he picked this specific time to come out of the closet and to declare his homosexuality because of the fact that he is nearing the end of his NBA career and may not be playing past this most recent season?
I think that had a lot to do with it. I mean, just thinking of it, I think it would be the best time. You know, it clearly is the best time. If he can live with himself, I mean, after he makes his decision to come out, but yet it doesn't necessarily affect his financial future because he said he realizes that his career is coming to an end. So, you know, instead of, you know, in his mind, like living a lie, if he can continue his career with the next organization knowing about him and not having to, you know, continue to keep it to himself, then I feel like he'll be more comfortable. But like you said, I think that that's exactly why he picked this time. He's a free agent, and so he would be able to live, you know, and be able to sleep at night saying, like, okay, no one wanted to pick me up, instead of, you know, basically tricking a team into signing him and then coming out, not tricking a team, but and that's basically, like, after he gets signed, then all of a sudden, you know, all this media hoopla about this and that is just kind of, you know, it's just not as honorable. So I think that's why he chose.
And Kudla, he's made a career out of his time in the NBA, has made bank, is able to financially support himself from all his years in the association now. So does it make it a safe time, a reasonable time for him to come out like he has?
I think it gives him some sort of ability to come out and say about his sexuality and feel completely comfortable with himself based off of his career and the fact that at this moment in time he might not need to be signed anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I agree with everything that's been said.
Because he's financially safe already, right? So if he doesn't get signed, he's all right past this point. He's all right not playing in the NBA ever again.
Correct. Yeah, he can basically do whatever he wants with his life and go about and live his life in a great way that he prefers, I guess you can say.
And, guys, let's make this a big roundtable discussion now and bring in two other guests, in Kara Jones, what was formerly known as Turco and Jones on CST Radio, my co-host from that very show, and then also Lauren Beasley of Sports Talk with Lauren Beasley, a fellow Blog Talk Radio sports show. Lauren and Carrick, welcome to the show, guys. Glad to have both of you on with us.
Happy to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
How's it going, V?
KJ, very good. And we have an important topic that we're discussing right now, talking about the topic of Jason Collins and his announcement in recent days to come out of the closet and become the first professional athlete, active one, to declare his homosexuality. And he's an NBA player, an impending free agent who might not ever play again in the association. Now, Lauren Beasley, do you believe that affected his decision to come out at this point in time?
I think partly it could have affected it, but at the end of the day, I think he just was ready to get this off his back. He wanted to come out in the open. You know, we all know Jason Collins has always been, you know, a role player, somebody just comes in and plays his role. So I definitely could see retirement in the very near future. Like I said, he hasn't, you know, he's not a big role player that a lot of teams look to go get because they think he can be an X factor or a key factor in their team and winning the championships. His retirement could be close, but I think this was just also something for him trying to make a statement, but at the same time just saying, you know what, I'm ready to let this out. I want it to be out now. And probably, like I said, because he is probably thinking about the next year or two probably of retiring as well. So, yeah, it's factoring probably a little bit.
And, Kara, do you think a team will give him a chance to play again now after this declaration has come out of him being a homosexual athlete? Will a team accept him into their locker room going forward, or has his career ended because of this statement made by Collins? Your thoughts on that?
It shouldn't. In fact, if someone doesn't sign him, I obviously think the NBA is full of bigots. And I don't think that it comes from just a media standpoint. A team that I don't even know where he would fit in here, but just knowing their owner, if he's going to sign with anybody, it's probably going to be the Dallas Mavericks, because Mark Cuban would just love that. Mark Cuban would eat that up. He would, oh, great, I now have a homosexual player on my team, and he's the first openly gay pro athlete that's during playing. Oh, that's going to bring me publicity.
So a good PR move, then, it could possibly lead to for the NBA team that signs Collins.
Yeah, because
including the Mavericks, if they may be interested in acquiring his services this offseason.
Exactly, because if someone doesn't sign him, then it looks bad for the whole NBA. And there's going to be gay rights groups that are going to be all over the NBA because somebody didn't give him a shot, whether he's, you know, he's even still a viable player. You know, a guy didn't
look at his skill set, though, guys. I mean, shouldn't we base it on that, his level of ability at this point in his career as an average role player at best, right?
We should base it off that, but we know how quickly people's minds change and can be, you know, skewered and goes to the opposite knowing that that's not the case. We look at it as analysts as, okay, let's be real, Jason Collins can't really help a team probably at this point. He's never really been that guy. He's been a solid player, but he's never been a guy, like I said, a key role player that I say he's the X factor that you need on your team. He's not a Birdman for the Heat. He's a guy that you say, okay, you know what, probably a leader, been here for a while, could probably help out some of the young guys a little bit, but that's about it. So we look at it as that, but certain people will say, oh, isn't it ironic now nobody wants to pick him up now that he's out? And it may not have anything to do with that, and it could. We wouldn't really know. But I see what McCarrick is saying as well, though, saying that that's how other people are possibly would probably take it. As you know, the NBA is full of bigots. Nobody wants to take him.
So the NBA has to give him a chance then? I mean, are we saying that then? Or
I don't think
the NBA will look horrible for not picking him up, right, if a team doesn't give him a chance. The NBA as a whole will look horrible as a league. Correct? If nobody picks him up, is that what we're dealing with right now, Lauren?
It's a possibility if nobody picks him up. Like, I don't think the whole world is going to go this route. I think you all have your unbiased people who, like ourselves, who will say, you know, maybe it has nothing to do with that. Maybe it's just the fact that he's not really a key player for somebody's team. But you will have some who will probably say it is probably because he came out. But like I said, I don't think it would be because of that. Like I said, every time I think of Jason Collins, you know, sometimes I have to remind myself who he is. That's not even trying to be funny. I like Jason Collins.
But he's not that viable.
He's not that hot of a commodity, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
He's been a role player for 12 years. He's nearing the end of his career. Is he even a viable option to go and pick up right now? Or the team that does, is it just a publicity stunt then for them to gain the favor of other owners and fans by doing so and satisfying the gay community in the process?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It could probably be a couple owners who probably would genuinely see a need in him. I mean, like I said, he is a veteran, and I've never heard anything bad about him not being a veteran that they can talk to. I've heard people say in Washington's locker room, he's a guy that, you know, you can talk to, you can get advice from, like he's been in the league, he's been to plenty of teams. So he does know what it takes to survive, even as a non-factor key role player, I guess you could say. But at the end of the day, I think that's the main thing that he brings to you is just veteran leadership and experience. But when it comes down to other things such as, you know, actual X-factor in the game, I can't say that he's necessarily helping you. I can't necessarily say he's helping you build up your young big man either, which is always another concern. Most times you're keeping a veteran big man on the team, you're also hoping that he can help a lot of these young big men who come in with no real big man skill set and continue to struggle in the NBA, but he doesn't necessarily offer that. So
yeah, he's definitely not an X-factor at this point. And
no.
He perhaps may be the last player off the bench for an NBA team going forward, really just taking up a roster spot. And Kara Jones, what do you think about the fact that a team picking him up has to deal with all the media attention now that will come with having him on their team? Do you think that affects a team and their mindset and whether or not to pick him up this offseason?
Obviously, I think it's a lot like the Tim Tebow situation. I really do. I think it's a lot like that in a guy that some people don't believe can perform has these values that he carries with him and is very open and honest about more than anyone else. And, you know, it's the same. I'm not comparing Christianity to being gay, but to an extent I am. You know, when you get Tim Tebow, you're getting a mediocre quarterback. And I know Brendan's probably still on here gritting his teeth, but,
yeah, he loves him some Tebow. I don't know about Matt Boyd, because we also have Matt Boyd on the show right now. I don't know if he's a Tebow lover, but
I'm a big
TK definitely is.
I think the same kind of thing, V, and I think if, you know, they're going to have to deal with it, but it's going to go away. You know, the hype of it is going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I first read that, when I got a message that he came out, I had no clue who he was. And I don't watch a lot of the NBA, but I know who's good. And I know who good depth guys are. So.
And he's not good. Truly, he's a scrub. Realistically, he's no more than a scrub at this point in his career. He might fill up a roster spot, take up that last spot on a bench, but that's the only kind of role he's going to have for an NBA team going forward, to be honest.
Agreed.
Now,
I think personally, if he gets picked
Matt
up,
Boyd?
I personally, it would be just a complete PR move if he were to get picked up completely.
Yeah. And I think so, too. I think he's a washed-up veteran, guys. And I think, Lauren and Carrick, you share that sentiment? Kudla, real quick, your thoughts on this before we move on to something else. And maybe some Tebow talk a little bit, just for you, Kudla.
Don't get me started on Tim Tebow because I can go for hours, and we only got a couple minutes left. But nonetheless, I think he's about
time.
Him getting signed could be veteran leadership. Not as long as also a PR move, obviously. But I feel like he does provide a little veteran leadership, and he can help guys figure out their role and really strive in a backup role or reserve role in the NBA.
Now, Kara, did you hear the comments made by Chris Broussard about Christianity and how it's everything Collins is for is against Christianity and what's in the Bible about gays and people that are homosexuals? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, no, I heard.
What do you
that.
Think
I
about mean, those comments, Kara Jones?
They should fire him. They should fire him.
Wasn't it too outlandish? I say keep a lot of that to yourself. You can take a stance as a Christian, but why go into it? Go as in-depth as he did, because he went overboard in doing so, in my opinion, Kara Jones.
He really did. To me, as someone who follows a very open version of Christianity that's almost as agnosticism, that goes to church with lots of openly gay people, I saw that, and that's I took that as he's making a racial slur on the air. It really felt like that to me, and
you don't like that, do you? What was that?
Not
tell me your opinion
media.
On this.
No, I like Kara Fisher, and I'll go. I don't want to cut him off. But like Kara Fisher said, and I'll go because he was saying something.
KJ,
I don't know. I just felt that it was very uncalled for. ESPN's owned by Disney and ABC, who are known to not be that conservative, a very liberal network, and I felt that, well, he's entitled to his own opinion, you know.
Yeah,
it's something
he's hired
to
do that, right? He's hired to voice his opinion, and he came on that show to voice his stance on the issue of Jason Collins coming out of the closet.
Didn't ESPN just fire a guy for having an opinion they didn't like? Remember, we're talking
that was Rob Parker, but he made a racist slur, too.
Well, I think it's that is a protected class. Homosexuals are a protected class, just like any racial thing would be, and I think it's slowly becoming a protected class, and he needs to be disciplined. I don't know what they've done, but maybe he needs to be suspended for a little while.
And Broussard's been shown up in the past, too, for not having credible sources or not naming his sources, so he's not the most credible or professional reporter they have for the NBA either. So if they got rid of him, not too many people would be ashamed of it. Let's just say that. But, Lauren, you have some thoughts on this issue as well. Voice your opinion.
I'm not a Chris Broussard fan at all when it comes to information, when it comes to his thoughts on the game at all. I've never been a Chris Broussard fan. But he is entitled to his opinion. Do I feel like he went overboard? Yes, I do feel like he went overboard. Did I agree with everything he said? No, I did not. I am a Christian. I feel we're all equal. I feel that we are all sinners. We all make mistakes. And that's more so when my problem came in. When he started bringing up, he didn't just bring up homosexuality. He brought up the fact that, if you have sex before marriage, if you commit adultery. My problem with him is he's focusing on those things just like all of us sin every day in some way, shape, or form. If that's the case, then what he's saying is, because basically he kept bringing up that it's a sin. And my whole thing with him is if you're saying that this is a sin, I've lied before. So if what you're saying is because I've sinned before, technically I can't be an open Christian. I can't be a person who has a relationship with God. And I didn't appreciate that because not everybody thinks that way. I get what he's saying. This is what he thinks and this is how he feels. And that's fine. Like I said, I don't agree with it at all, but I'm not going to disrespect him about it. He has his opinion. I have mine.
Yep.
But
everybody has their own opinion, right?
Right, we got to agree to disagree. I just didn't like the fact that we kept bringing up sin. I'm like, we all sin, like I said,
everybody
we all
does.
Sin, and we have to repent, and we have to do what we have to ask God for forgiveness, and he does. That's what, unless you are God, which nobody on here or in this world is God, he's the only one who can judge as far as I'm concerned. We have no right to judge each other. We do it all the time. It's human nature. Once again, that's a sin. But we do it, and if that's the case, then basically what we're all saying is that none of us can technically be Christians or have an open relationship with God, according to what Chris Broussard said, and that's what I did not like. That he's basically saying none of us can be with this, like within God in our own way, because we're all sinning, and I didn't like that.
Boyd?
If I could say something first, correct me if I'm wrong. I heard the majority of the of what he said, but not in its entirety. But it seemed to me like he was more advocating saying that anyone who blatantly stands behind their sin, cannot have, like that open relationship with you, God. Not like in a essence, anybody who's sinning. But the way I took it is anyone who stands behind their sin. Like, for instance, if I'm an adulterer, if I'm promoting adultery, to the nation, and I'm standing mm-hmm. behind it, that I am an adulterer and this is what I do, and there's nothing wrong with this, then that is mm-hmm. There becomes an issue. And I believe that's what more of Jason Collins is doing. Like, everyone, like you said, everyone's a sinner. Everyone has their own sins. But
yep.
to battle those demons within your own house in the comfort of your own home is the difference between stepping out on the forefront and promoting them and saying that this is okay and this is right. I think that's how I took with I forgot to ask mm-hmm. his name.
Chris Broussard,
Chris Broussard. That's what I took as his comments as, and since I took it that way, I really tend to agree with him, and I with at least that statement that he said, that as far as promoting and standing behind your sins, like.
Okay. Okay. So, Lauren, you think he was comparing adultery then to being gay, coming out as a gay athlete?
I agree with what he's saying.
Making it public.
I agree partly with just what Matt just said. He's saying if you stand by it and different things of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I've lied before, and then I say, I'm going to do my best not to do it again. I'm not going to stand in front. I've lied again. Doesn't mean I'm standing behind it, And like I said, I understand what Chris Broussard is saying. But like I said, technically you have no right to judge what any of us do or what we say. Like I said, Jason Collins, well, it's right, or this is who I am. This is who he is. He's trying to
That's
be
who he is,
who
right?
He is. God created him this way. This is who he is. Did he make a choice? I don't know. I'm not going to get into the whole gay situation of is it a choice.
And remember,
I'm not gay. I don't want to get into that.
God doesn't make mistakes, too, right? He accepts everyone who's supposed to, right? Except that he does. He accepts everyone and doesn't make mistakes. So Jason Collins is not a mistake. That's just who he is. And we got to accept that, I guess, to some degree.
And that's exactly why I understand it's hard not to bring religion into it, because most of us are religious people in some way, shape, or form, whether it be Christian, Catholic, Muslim, whatever we are. We're all some form normally of religion. We come from it. We're raised around it. At some point, we know about it. But like I said, for me, this is what is the problem. We start bringing religion into it when it really doesn't have to be brought into it. Like I said, this is his choice. This is who he is. Let it go, okay? Like I said, whether you stand around or not, this is who he is. You have no right to disrespect him. Just like I have no right to disrespect anybody else for their choice, and they have no right to disrespect me for my choice, whether it be gay, whether it be cheating, like I said, whatever it is, whether it be lying. I understand we all make mistakes. We all sin. We all are people who are supposed to be equal. God created us each for a special purpose, and he does not make mistakes. But like I said, when people bring religion into it, it just becomes even more futile and vulgar, because more and more people have their opinions on what everybody makes their own interpretations of the Bible and what it means. There are different interpretations of the Bible. There are different interpretations of what God says in the Bible. Everybody has their own interpretations of everything that goes on in religion.
Lauren, nobody has the power to judge besides for God. Nobody should, because of that, too. It's up to God how he determines what kind of person, the quality of a person that you are. And being gay, being homosexual, lesbian, bisexual does not define who you are either. And I think we have to take that into account and let the religion go beside the point. Throw that to the side. Don't worry about that right now. It shouldn't be a religious issue where we totally make it something that correlates with religion, because it's not a religious debate. It's not about that. It's about an athlete who came out of the closet, making a stance for himself and maybe some other professional athletes that will follow his suit.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest thing to take from it, in my opinion.
Agree.
And, guys, specifically Matt Boyd and you, Lauren, as two African-Americans, would you consider the comments made by Chris Broussard against Jason Collins to be similar to the racial slur made by Rob Parker, in which he called RG3 a cornball brother? Are the comments similar to what Rob Parker said on ESPN First Take and was fired for?
Just want to make sure I reiterate, I didn't hear the entire conversation that Chris Broussard said, but from what I did hear, from what I did hear, I don't put those in the same category. I believe that he was stating his opinion. Like we said earlier, you know, he is entitled mm-hmm. to his opinion. I don't believe mm-hmm. that he should be fired because I don't believe that's like a racial slur. I don't believe he said anything derogatory.
Not.
I believe he spoke mm-hmm. his mind, you know, and I believe that he got his opinion off his chest, and I believe there's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that. I don't think it was mm-hmm. anything derogatory, or he didn't take any shots or say anything profane about the gay community. So, no,
mm-hmm.
I don't think he should be reprimanded at all.
And, Lauren, I think we both agree. He just voiced his opinion, right? And he's hired. He was told to come on Outside the Lines to do that. And he took his stance, said what he had to. Simple as that, right?
I don't have a problem. Like I said, I didn't agree with everything, but like I said, I was not on this one. This is not the same thing as what Rob Parker did. Yes, was it still a little out of line? Possibly, in your opinion. But like I said, I don't feel like he strictly just made it about Jason Collins being a homosexual or being black. And like I said, I don't think it would have mattered who it was. I don't think this would have mattered if it had been Marv Albert, if this had been Shaquille O'Neal. I honestly don't think he would have cared. This is just his opinion from a religious standpoint, and like I said, while I might have kept certain things to myself, he was asked to come onto the show and voice his opinion as a Christian. That was the first thing that came out of his mouth. As a Christian, how do you feel about this Christian star? And he answered the question. I might have kept certain things to myself, but then at the same time, he wanted to let his opinion be known. Some agree, some disagree, and that's just the way it is. But I don't think that there should be any type of hard punishment for that. Like I said, if anything, maybe you just tell him, look, Chris, we don't mind you having your opinion, but certain things we're just not comfortable with you saying on this platform. You want to write an article? You want to do a podcast? Go ahead. That's your free will. But we just don't feel necessarily comfortable with you doing that on our network because that's not what we want. Or we don't want people judging us off that. But if any, and like I said, that would be up to ESPN if they or whoever outside the lines, whoever, if they want to go about that. But that, at the most, to me, a talk just saying if they're not comfortable with it or they're getting so much flack from it, just talk to Chris Broussard yourself and just say, hey, Chris, you got to keep that type of stuff to yourself if it's that big of a deal. If it is, Chris Broussard can choose to agree or disagree with it. And then if he wants, he can always go out in a different venture and let out thoughts on a totally different venture that has nothing to do with ESPN.
And let's end the Jason Collins discussion for today's show with that. Thank you very much, Lauren. And Matt, mm-hmm. I'll let you go with that. Thank you very much for your time on the very first edition of Churko & Company. It was a pleasure having you on, man.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate it, man. Anytime.
All right, have a good one.
Good luck in your football career.
Yeah, good
thanks,
luck.
I appreciate it. Goodbye.
And Lauren Carrick and Brennan Kudla still on the show with me right now. Let's transition to Ray McCallum and the decision he made in the last few minutes we have for today's show, looking at whether or not maybe he left a little bit early, guys. Carrick, let's start with you as the UDM Hoops Insider for Churko & Company, not only during this summer but also during the school year on CST Radio. What are your thoughts on the decision made by Ray to forego his senior year of eligibility at UDM to enter the NBA draft?
Well, you know, I was really shocked at first. I didn't believe the report, and there's a lot of multiple reporters reporting it could have been false. After making some calls, talking to Carlton Brundage and Patrick Iwanu, I got the relay that Coach McCallum told Ray when they got his stock back he would be between a just outside the lottery pick and a top five in the first round from the draft advisory board, and it was his choice. Ray felt that he could make an immediate impact on a team if he was drafted in the late round, and decided because he's graduating this summer that it was time to take his talents to the NBA. You know, it's going to hurt the team, but I'm not so sure about that, but we'll get to that later. You know,
well, we might not have time for that on today's show, actually, but I would like to get into that.
You can. I was going to say, Blog Talk will allow you to go over time as long as you like, by the way. I was going to tell you.
We have the archived edition still remaining, but I'm saying of the live edition of the show.
You know, it's his choice, and it was his time, and it's too bad. I don't know if staying would have helped him. You know, you look at the kid from Lehigh, C.J. McCollum. His stock really didn't rise or fall with staying a year. He's really about the same. So, you know, it's his choice, and Ray felt that it was time, and I trust him as a player. He's a real smart player on the court, and I feel he can make an immediate impact, you know, at a team that he's drafting late in the first round, like an OKC, like L.A. Clippers, you know, like Miami Heat, like a New York Knicks, one of those teams where he'll be able to step right on the floor. We've seen and we've heard from our good friend Rashad Phillips that he has more of an NBA game. So I think it could be too early, but I'm going to trust Ray's opinion on this.
Lauren, with 60 seconds remaining or so, your thoughts on this, on Ray leaving early.
It's fine. You know, I have to agree with KJ just said. I said the same thing. You know what? I don't think it's like I said, this is a weaker draft. Next year, it's going to be tons of great point guards coming out in this draft that unless his stock rises up, he becomes a better facilitator for a general, becomes a heck of a shooter or a better shooter. Lead now. Like I said, I'm trusting Ray. I do think he has an NBA-ready game. He proves that he can score. He proves that he can facilitate. I think he can facilitate even better than what he did at Detroit Mercy. And as long as he continues to improve his jump shot, because he is known for having a little bit of an inconsistent shooting stroke, he can be fine. He can go to a team, like they said, like the Knicks, like OKC, a team who really needs a backup point guard, a team where he can learn from some of these veteran point guards and hopefully get an immediate impact type of opportunity. But like I said, unless you're going to get better or unless you're gonna, your stock is going to rise, and I mean, dang on there, you can guarantee it, there's no reason for him to stay and not just enter into this week draft, like, especially with a lot of the point guard play that's going to be coming out in next year's draft. So this is a fine move by Ray McCollum. Like I said, it'll be
a crop of point guards, right? He's number 6 in the class, in the top 10. Could very well be in the top 5 with a good combine showing, too.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the class is very weak. Same thing I said about Tim Hardaway at Michigan. Same thing. You know, like I said, some people said he should stay. I'm not saying he shouldn't stay. I'm just saying unless he feels like his game is going to elevate to a whole other level, he's going to work on his point guard skills. He's going to become a better slasher. He's going to become a better facilitator. There's no reason for this guy to stay and try to make it in next year's draft when the guard play is going to probably be stronger with the guys coming out. It's just better for these guys to leave now. Like the certain guys, you have to take your opportunities when they come. In Ray's case, I think he would be fine if he stayed for a senior year, but at the same time, I don't think I don't think his stock is going to get higher. I'm not sure Ray is going to improve any more than he already has at this level. I think any growth he does now will probably be in the NBA.
And Kudla, do you think that McCollum felt that he achieved everything he could have at UDM in winning Horizon League Player of the Year already, winning a Horizon League Tournament Championship and going to a tournament game, playing against Kansas in the first round? Do you believe that maybe affected his decision?
I think that played a role in his decision. However, I think the weaker draft class played the biggest role in his decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, graduating is a good thing. He could always go back and do that. And I really just think the lack of point guard depth in this draft,
mm-hmm,
giving him the opportunity to potentially even sneak into the late first round as a point guard and go to somewhere, maybe if he gets lucky, he can drop down somewhere toward the Lakers, somewhere around there if he goes that high, I mean, I guess in the first round. Where
he wants
he's
to play
for
the Lakers, though, right now. They're decimated by injuries, in turmoil. Dwight Howard's going to leave, maybe. I'm just joking. I mean, he'll take the job if he can get it. But,
yeah, but I'm just saying this is a weak draft, and it's going to give him an opportunity to go somewhere and potentially learn very quickly and learn on the job. So I think this is a very, very educated move by Ray McCollum, probably using lots of advice from his father as well. And I think it's a very smart move for him to try to go to the draft and try his luck in the combine and see where he can end up.
Now, Kierig, Ray McCollum leaving UDM, how does that affect the team starting with this upcoming season? How much worse are we now off, UDM as a whole, without Ray McCollum in the backcourt?
We don't know because we're still actively recruiting quite a few guards. We've had so many transfers, and it's not funny. Trey Ziegler came in yesterday, and he said before his visit he was guaranteed to go to UC Davis. Afterwards, he texted Patrick Iwanu and told him that he might come to U of D for a year if his dad becomes a coach. It's really up in the air.
Ziegler's
like
dad as an assistant coach under McCollum,
yeah,
then, right? Is that what you're talking
the
about?
The rumors right now that the two new U of D assistants, and these are just rumors, will be Jermaine Jackson and Ernie Ziegler. Those are the rumors that I've heard from multiple sources. You know, what it did was Jason Calise decided he is most likely going to come back, which was someone we knew, wanted to leave with all his injuries he's had and try his luck getting on the Raptors practice squad. But he told P.J. Boutte yesterday he looks forward to playing with him next year. So I think that kept a player, Ray leaving. I really do.
So Jason's staying now, you think?
He's leaning towards staying. He hasn't fully decided, but he's told multiple players he wants to stay and play with them. So that would be big.
Because honestly, right now, I think we need a guy like that to stay for some experience and veteran leadership for next year's basketball team at UDM.
Yeah, all the excitement's gone anyways,
all the star power from last year's team and Doug Anderson with his high-flying dunks and Nick Minaraff's gone. And then Ray now, I mean, who do we have left that's very exciting to go to Callahan to watch, to make you want to go to Callahan to watch a Titan basketball game?
The people that followed Southfield when they went to the state finals are going to flock to Callahan to watch Carlton and Pat play together. Pat had high major offers and chose to go to Texas Southern, and it did not work out. Carlton went to Michigan. Trey Burke became an amazing player. It did not work out. You're forgetting that Carlton had a higher rating than Ray coming out of high school, but was further down because his class was deeper.
But he's been a year removed, too, from playing collegiate basketball.
2 years removed. But they're going on their Europe trip in July. Those jitters, all that I haven't played in 2 years, is going to go away because this is the year the team gets to do their trip overseas. The team will have bonded. They'll have played semi-pro and pro teams over there. And that 2 years of not playing and the adjustment for Patrick and any other junior college players we get, they'll have already integrated before we even start fall practice. That's the biggest thing that people don't understand about how this team's going to be. I'm not saying, you know, they're going to go back to the tournament. I think that if everyone blends, that could happen. You know, we're still hot on a very good guard right now in a guy, Freewell, Charles Freewell's nephew. We're in his top three. He's going to decide soon. He could be a guard that can immediately.
How good is he, though? Is he a four-star recruit or five-star recruit? I mean, how good is he, though?
He was rated by ESPN as a 70 out of high school. And he played at a great school, a Gate Christian, down in Florida, that's produced some great players. He's high on our list. We also, obviously, we know how good Trey Ziegler is. You know, he dominated in the MAC.
Did he really dominate, though? Central Michigan never did anything with him and his dad.
He himself.
I don't think he really dominated, though. He's never been a Ray McCallum, though, at the collegiate level. He's never really lived up to the bill or to expectations, per se, yet. So can he still be that player at this point after a few years of already playing college ball?
For 1 year, I will take a Reynolds to make the team better. I will absolutely take a Reynolds to make the team better. I think that's the best situation because then you can go get a player. We can go put all our chips on A.J. Turner and Justin Tillman, who were both heavily recruiting for 2014. And
Turner can be the star, right? He can be the star now without Ray.
Well,
the next best at UDM.
It's the Carlton-Brundage show until Carlton leaves. That's it. We know by his personality that he is going to command all the attention. And, I mean, nobody came to U of D to play with Ray. Ray didn't call up players and say, hey, come play with me. Three of our current recruits, Carlton said, hey, come play with me, and we already got one to sign.
All right, so Lauren Beasley, does Kurt Jones like Carlton Brundage just a little bit too much, or is he being realistic here where Brundage can possess the star power to lead UDM back to the promised land, meaning back to the tournament?
I had the great opportunity to watch Carlton grow. You know, me and Carlton, I mean, heck, goodness gracious, we graduated pretty much right around each other. But my thing with Carlton is this. Like I said, Carlton has star power. The problem with Carlton is what position are you going to have him at? Because the problem with Carlton was he always had the skill set of a two but has the body of a one. And he doesn't necessarily have a one skill set unless that's changed in the last couple of years. When he went to Michigan, no offense to, you know, him going to Michigan and playing around Trey Burke, he didn't have the skill set of the one to really constantly compete. So like I said, the scoring wise, like, the boy's a beast. Like I said, that's never been a problem with Carlton. Carlton can score. It's just more so if Coach McCollum is putting him at the one, I'm going to look forward to seeing how his facilitation skills have improved. Can he really be a guy who can lead this team from a point guard standpoint? I know
yeah, so where does he play the two then? You're saying he's better suited to play the two, right, than the one?
Well, his skill set fits the two, but he doesn't have the height and the size to compete with every single two in the Horizon League and possibly in non-conference, which was always the problem. I mean, I remember that's what pretty much myself and a lot of scouts used to say about Carlton when he played at Southfield was he's playing two, but he really has the body of a one. But he doesn't have, I mean, you know, most people remember Desmond Barnes, you know, was the one for Southfield. So I'm like, you know, he didn't really play the one. So like I said, when he went to Michigan, I'm thinking to myself, this is probably not going to work out. Trey is there. Then on top of that, they're getting in Derek Walton after that. Carlton doesn't have the point guard skill set to compete. And no offense to Carlton, you're not too hyped. Now, in the Horizon League, it may work. Like I said,
yeah,
but that's the one that I'm looking at. he can get away with it probably a little bit more in the Horizon League than he did the Big Ten, because Big Ten guards are a little bit bigger, but at least at the two position they are. So, like I said, maybe Horizon League can get away with actually playing two, but I'm not. I don't
so
think
where does
JJ's
he start next season, though? To put you on the hot seat right now, if you had to make a bold prediction, would he? You think
well,
he's going to start at the one or two next season?
I was going to match the two. Like I said, unless something has changed with facilitation skills, and of course, you know, since I'm no longer on the staff, I'm not in practice every day, so all I know is facilitation skills may have improved drastically. He may really have turned himself into a nice young point guard. I'm just going by the last time I saw him, and last time I saw him, he was still that same scorer Carlson I remember, who wasn't necessarily the guy that said, hey, bring my ball up the court and facilitate, create, and score for me. And that's really my concern. So I wouldn't mind putting him at the two. But at the same time, who do you count on your coach McCollum to put him at the – who are you going to put at the one? Because, like, we said for so long, Ray was
that
guy.
I mean, is PJ going to start at the one? I don't think he's good enough to start.
I don't want him starting.
So then that's the question. Who do you put at the one? And that's where the dilemma is. You can put Carlson there. I'm just not, like I said, and like I said, KJ would know more than I do because he's around this team if his point guard skills have improved. Like I said, I'm going by last time I saw Carlson, last time I talked to Carlson. And like I said, I remember specifically about his game. He was a two. He was a scorer. Could hit the three. Could get past you. He had that smooth game. He wasn't super quick. He always used – I used to compare him a lot to like a Brandon Roy or Paul Pierce. Not very quick. Not necessarily very strong, but just so smooth with the ball that he could just score – in any way, sense, or any way, shape, or form. But like I said, I think he's a scorer, but the question is, if you do move him to the two, who's your one in this game? Because that's the question. You need somebody to be a facilitator.
Lauren, I forgot about your role on the team a few years back when you were still at UDM. You were a student manager?
Yeah, student manager and scout, you know, because my background came from when I was at my high school Detroit consortium. I was actually a scout on their staff, and I actually helped a lot of those young men get to college. So Coach McCollum was one of the coaches I was talking to, because at the time he was interested in Vincent Hunter. So me and him were talking, and then he said, I can use somebody like you as a student manager. You can help me out with some of the recruiting as well, help me keep an eye on it. So I said, sure, and I'm coming, and it ended up being a great experience. You know, obviously that was the year they won Horizon League Championship, so it was a great experience, great opportunity, and I love every moment of it, and I miss those guys every day, because they were a crazy bunch.
Well, Lauren, what you saw from practices with your time as part of UDM and on the staff, what did you see out of Carlton when he went head-to-head with Ray, though? Because they went head-to-head in practice, right? In scrimmage.
Well, yeah, I didn't see Carlton at Detroit much. The last time I saw Carlton and Ray go head-to-head was in high school.
Okay,
and in high school, it was always competitive. You know, Carlton and Ray, you know, they're no different than Ray and Keith Ashland. When Pershing and Detroit Country, they would go at it. It was always intense. Ray didn't pull any punches. Ray didn't pull any punches. They both went at it. And like I said, one thing I love about both the guys was they both were versatility scorers who could score just about anywhere on the floor. Carlton always had a nice jump shot, but Carlton was also smooth enough and had a nice decent enough handle to get to the rim at times and definitely make some plays happen. He has good athleticism, and then Ray was the same way. Like, the only thing I would say Ray had over Carlton was that he was a little bit more better in transition, but that's because Southfield didn't necessarily get out in transition as much. You know, when Detroit Country, they got in transition, they had the guys on that team to get out and go to transition. But I will say I do like Carlton and Pat's chemistry as well, though. I mean, that was one thing I loved when I used to watch Southfield. Carlton and Pat always had great chemistry, you know, to a point where I used to say, hey, this is a nice two-man game that I can feel comfortable with. I think that was probably when I saw the best facilitation skills out of Carlton was when Pat was with him. And I'm happy to hear that Pat is coming to Detroit Mercy.
Let's ask Kierick now about Carlton playing the one. Can he do it as a starter on a full-time basis as soon as next season, Kierick Jones?
It depends who's on the court. I would feel more comfortable with Jason handling the ball. Carlton thinks he can handle the ball. Carlton also thinks that he's going to be Horizon League Player of the Year. He is one of my best friends, but I do worry about his skill set. He can score. I've watched him go against Ray in practice. I've watched him make a mockery of multiple guys in practice. I think the guy you got to look at to possibly run the point, even though he's a big boy, is Anton. Anton can carry
Anton
a ball.
Is he a shooter, though?
Anton can move the ball up the court, and he has very good chemistry with Carlton. So if
Carlton
messes up, they're going to go and their coach is going to put Anton. I can guarantee you right now, even if Jason stays, you're probably going to watch Juwan Howard start games on the bench because of the issues with chemistry. I mean, you have Pat, Carlton, and Anton who have played together before and are very good friends. So,
well, guys, I know we haven't forgotten. Lauren, real quick, I know we haven't forgotten about my co-host of the show today, Brendan Kudla. Kudla, do you have any thoughts on any of this that we've discussed in the past 5 to 10 minutes?
I've been keeping a close eye here and listening about the old Carlton Brundage talk. And I remember watching him in high school and the way he plays the game.
And he played against Phil too, if you remember right, Kudla.
Very good defense, very good offensive player, sorry. Very good offensive player. Attacks the rim like nobody I've ever seen before and loves to score, obviously. But one of those things is right now we're talking about him at U of D as if he's the second coming of Trey Burke at Michigan as a scoring aspect of it, being able to get to the cup and score every time. Yes, he might be able to do that at the Horizon League level. However, right now he's unproven.
And there's a reason why Burke played ahead of him at U of M, right? There has to be.
There's a, obviously, well, we see what Trey Burke has done. But in a standpoint of can he do it, there's a lot of pressure being put on him, and him thinking so highly of himself and being able to rely on his background of how he can put the ball in the hoop at any given time, could that play a role to the demise of maybe UOD this season, giving him the ball and having him fail a little bit, and could that cause a little bit of concern for you guys as a team? If he struggles, does the whole team go down, or is there someone able to pick up the slack? Because it seems like Carlton Brundage is going to be the star as of what everyone's making it out to be.
So, Kira, can he lead the team, and are you concerned that if he tries to, will he shoot the team out of games? I mean, will he be a ball hog and force up shots and unnecessary shots, or is he not that type of player?
I got to watch him in high school twice. I have two good friends, one that plays Milwaukee School of Engineering, and one that plays at Adrian that played on Carlton's team at camp. And when he would start to tire or miss shots, they would come and, you know, he would give the ball up. When I saw him playing with Anton and Jason on the line when Ray was under the weather last year in practice, he missed two shots in a row. Coach called a timeout, and he started passing the ball. So when Carlton gets in the zone, he gets out of it and he's playing the game and he misses. Usually he'll pass, but he is the type of player that has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder and an ego, and I'm just going to shoot myself out of this, you know, out of this slump, and that could get us into trouble. The good news is we have non-conference to deal with that.
So the best realistic expectations for Carlton Brundage next season, Lauren, are what in your opinion?
First off, I know Carl speaks highly of himself, but like we said, you know, first off, let's make sure we figure out the identity of this team as itself. I mean, like I said, I don't think this all should be on Carlton to make or break this team succeed. I think there's plenty of good players on this team who can step up. Like I agree with what KJ said about Anton Wilson. This is somebody else who I got a chance to watch and grow back when he was at Flint. Carmen Ainsworth down in Flint, he was a heck of a shooter. He was considered as one of the best shooters in the state. He nearly averaged 15 points per game as a junior. I mean, he's a guy that you can count on. Jason is a guy that you can count on. Carlton's a guy that you can count on. You have guys on this team that you should, Evan Brunson's guys that you can count on. These are guys that you have to collectively put together and see how you fit as a team. You don't necessarily want to say, hey, Carlton, be what Ray was or be what Trey was. We're saying Carlton, play your game and find a way to fit. That's what I think the problem is. We're all of a sudden, or not necessarily us, but people all of a sudden are just saying, hey, Carlton, kind of be what Ray was. And I don't want Carlton trying to be what Ray was. Be Carlton. Now, I've seen Carlton force shots, and I've seen Carlton slow down and pass the ball and give opportunity to other teammates. But regardless of whether he's doing it, that's when it goes back to Coach McCullough. You're the head coach.
And are we going to be able to run in God?
You control him. You control him. You know, this is, you know, you control him just like you had to control Ray at times. I saw Ray force up shots at times that I was like, Ray, what are you doing? I saw Doug do it. I saw the only person I could probably say I didn't see do it a lot was Nick, and that's just because that's the kind of guy Nick is. But that's when it comes down to Coach McCullum and the rest of his coaching staff. Like I said, you know, Carlton has the potential to be a heck of a player on this team, potential to be Horizon League Player of the Year. But like I said, let's relax on just putting needs to relax and all the rest of us need to relax. We got to really just see what comes about with this team. Like I said, if anything, this team can collectively be a good team all around without having to say, oh, my God, Carlton's Ray or Carlton is Trey.
Yep.
Like I said, he may be our go-to guy, and he may be our guy that we say, close out this game, win this game for us. Really, that's what's the main thing you need. You have
But they're going to be a cohesive unit, you think, a good starting five with Carlton.
We can have a cohesive unit. If anything with Carlton, I want Carlton to be that guy that Ray was in the sense of, and Trey Burke was, that, hey, close this game out for us. when we're in close games, I want to feel comfortable that you got my team back, that you got my back. I don't necessarily need you to score 20 and 30 and be that guy. You do it great, but more than anything, be that leader. Be that guy that they can count on to keep the team calm. Be that guy who's in the locker room and on the bench that we can count on. That's who he should focus on being, because regardless of who Carlton is trying to be, Carlton is a natural scorer. He's going to score. I don't want him trying to force it. Be you. If
now,
anything, focus on being that leader.
Kirk, how about playing up-tempo offense with Carlton? What do you think about that? Can we still play that up-tempo style of offense that we played with Ray? Especially
Carlton
this past season.
Carlton is not as fast as Ray. He's not slow, but he's not Speedy McGee. He's not a jackrabbit. He likes to take his time.
He's not a jackrabbit like you, Kirk Jones, right?
Yeah. I would say that they're going to play a lot. They're going to play up tempo, but it's going to be more of a lot like Duke plays. We're going to play up tempo. Our bigs aren't really big. They like to stretch the floor, because you're going to see a lot of Evan Bruins the next season, and you're going to see a lot of Patrick Awanu stepping out and shooting threes. It's going to be a lot more of a Duke style offense. And I know you're going to get on me because I'm a Duke guy, but it's going to be that type of.
Does himself some Blue Devils. He does.
None of our guys are huge, but all but one are going to step to the outside and shoot threes. You thought we shot a lot of threes last year. This year, if you're going to have Howard, Wilson, Brundage, Bruinsma, who can shoot the three, and Patrick Iwana, who is very good at stepping out and shooting threes, they're going to live and die by the three more this year than last year. Because right now, unless they signed some huge guy, and MJ becomes, he eats the buffet every day, you're not going to have a big power center. You're going to have
There's no reliable big man option on our squad right now,
but
especially at center. Nobody that can score the basketball good enough.
If you go back to the last game of the season, you go back to the Arizona State game, and, me and you especially, and I don't know how much Lauren's watched, NJ is getting better. Europe will help him. He'll be able to be a serviceable center. I am not saying he's going to have 10 points a game, but I'm saying he's going to be 5 fouls, and he's going to knock the ball out of other people's hands. NJ, after the season, I talk to him. I eat dinner with him probably twice a month, and he is...
Take showers with him, too, and spend time in his bedroom with him, and...
No.
He's a
dear friend of mine. He was upset with himself, and he's been lifting, he's been working out. I think NJ can be the guy that knocks the ball away from the other team. I'm not going to say that he's not Eli Holman, and
nowhere near Eli Holman, to say the least.
I think he's the opposite of Eli Holman in every facet of his life.
And the Titans are missing a big body presence like Eli Holman underneath the boards, who can bang with the big boys.
I think the only recruit we're even hot on that we have a chance with in this 2013 class that could be the next Eli Holman is Keon Sales from Westside Christian, but he has no meat on his bones either. So, they got to start serving steaks in Callahan. That's what I think.
Some big boy food, right? Some manly food.
I mean, right now, I can't play a lick of basketball, but I might be the best option they have for center.
Yeah, it's not good if that's the case, at your 5'2 stature, right?
Yeah.
Not a pretty picture, then.
I'm 5'5", so that's the only issue with this team. Other than that, they're going to have good chemistry. The only player besides Ray that's leaving early, Gabe Dos Santos, has been released. He's going to take his talents, I believe, to Auburn or Florida International.
And that's not a big loss, so.
No, it's not, and you know what? He's a hot weather kid, and the cold was just getting to him. Not playing out is going to get to you. Great guy.
Yeah, I think it was more the PT factor, to be honest. He wasn't playing enough for his liking, most likely.
Well, I spent time with him that last week at school, and he really hates the cold. He is originally from Brazil, so, you can just factor that in.
Well,
but
I might hate the cold, too, but I still like UDM, and I wouldn't switch
schools
automatically just because of the cold weather climate.
I think
you can't
another,
just base it on the climate, right?
Another thing to look at for UDM basketball is obviously Ziegler, even though he said, hey, I'm going to UC Davis, you can only imagine if his dad gets hired, he's going to say, guess what, we're going to make you eligible.
And why would you want to go to UC Davis over UDM with Ray leaving, too?
He
can be more of the star in the backcourt, right, and get the basketball and score it. get a lot of opportunities for that at a D1 school. Better D1 school, for sure.
Yeah, well, let's just be real. I mean, Trey is not the best guy when it comes to knowing what he wants. I mean, if we want to laugh, he's basically the Dwight Howard of basketball right now for us. I mean,
there's a reason why he's transferred, right, already from two schools
now. Yeah, I mean,
now.
You know, I like him, but, you know, he hasn't. And, I mean, even with Gabriel DeSanta, I mean, like I said, I preach this a lot, you know, with these guys. Even Carlson, when he once chose to go to Michigan, knowing where you're going. You know, knowing where you're going. Like, I just said Central because Dad was there. Fine. Things didn't work out. Your dad got fired. Okay, I can understand that. But once again, you're transferring for the third time now. Well, you know, what's going on? Like I said, pick the schools that fit you. You know, Gabriel DeSanta, I mean, okay, even if it's not the cold weather, even if it goes down to playing time, know who's on the roster. Know how you fit into a system. Same thing with Carlton. When Carlton chose Michigan, I'm thinking to myself, do you know who Trey Burke is? I know you highly do, but you probably played against him at Ohio when you played.
Well, Trey Burke wasn't as highly touted, so I'll give Carlton that much, though.
Yeah, but he wasn't highly touted, but he played against Trey. He knew who Trey was. You have to do your homework as a recruit. I'm sick of these kids transferring because they don't do their homework, and then they want to. In fact, quite frankly, to me, Carlton was always a mid-major player anyway. There wasn't a lot of big-time D1 schools offering Carlton. John Beilein was one of the main ones who jumped up because he had a great AAU showing, and he said, I want to get on the first, be one of the first people to offer this kid. It wasn't like Carlton was having big-time offers here, and that's fine. But like I said, Carlton has to do his homework, and then he realized, you know what, Derek Walton is also coming here. Now let me start thinking about possibly going to play. But me personally, I always thought Carlton would do great under Detroit Mercy, whether Ray was there or not. Because I just always felt like he would fit better in that level, that system. Gabriel DeSanto, like I said, you're mad about playing time. You're mad about the coach. You knew that when you came to Detroit. We're a four-season state city. You know that, okay? And then as far as playing time, are you looking at the roster? Do you know who you're going to have to compete with? Even who's coming in with you? I mean, I'm not saying you got to go and get film on these guys, but just do your little homework about some of these guys.
So Beasley has a beef with recruits. Definitely
you
have a beef, don't you?
No, because I work with recruits. It's not about having a beef. It's just about working with recruits day in and day out.
It sounds like you might have a beef, though, Beasley, just a little bit.
If you want to call it a beef, you can choose to use that word. But like I said, my background comes from recruits. That's how Coach McCullough and me even got a chance to meet. So for me, I deal with a lot of recruits every time we sit down and we look at offers and we look at opportunities for these guys. And I'm always stressing, just do your homework. You know what I mean? Look and see. What do you really want to be? You really want, okay, freshman year. Are you looking to play freshman year or are you looking to learn freshman year? Okay, you said you want to go to Detroit Mercy. You want to go to Michigan. You want to go here. Are you looking at the roster and seeing it? Okay, I'm a guard. It's already four guards on the team who are between junior and sophomore year. Does that really mean I'm going to get playing time? You can't just go by what a coach tells you or what you think is going to happen. That's my thing. It's not a beef. It's just about these guys collectively making good decisions for themselves. Certain things.
So maybe a beef with transfer students, then more of transfer students than actual recruits.
Like I said, you're using the word beef. The word beef, trying to create controversy for whatever reason. That's your decision. Like I said, it's not a beef. It's just saying do your homework. Certain things can't be helped. Like I said, coaches being fired. Maybe now the system is changing. Like I said, that's out of your hands. That's just like if I went to Detroit Mercy playing and my coach got fired. I can't help that. Maybe I'm not happy with the coaching. But when guys pick a school that they say, I fit in this system, or I think I'm going to do good here, and then I hear a year later you're transferring, it's like, well, what happened? Did you do your homework? Did you look at the guys who were coming? You should know
enough about the coach going into your decision, right, before you make that decision to go and select a school.
Not even the coach. Like I said, a coach being fired is not necessarily a worse thing. Like, that can't be helped. You're not psychic. I'm saying, I remember vividly Trey Zegler saying, Pittsburgh, you know, I think I'll fit well here. I think I can help out here. Then when I heard he's transferring, he's saying, I didn't see myself fitting into the system. At the beginning,
but he's contradicting himself. He should know better going into it.
That's not
what you're saying. Do more homework about the situation, right?
Do your homework. Yeah, just do your homework.
Yeah.
And that's not just for all these young student athletes. And I know all these guys are 17, 18-year-old boys making big decisions about their lives. It's not easy. It's 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds who can't make decisions. I'm not getting upset and saying, you know, go to HELL here. I'm just saying, guys, I really would like some of these guys to really just sit back sometimes and really just really take the time to really just pick the school that fits them and why it fits them. How does this benefit me? How does this hurt me? What do I have to do to get to where I want to be? And I know sometimes not every recruit But some recruits just don't do that. And that's on all levels of sports. And I think sometimes that's why we see the transferring that we do. And like I said, sometimes I feel like a lot of it can be avoided. You know, sometimes these guys just really sit back and do their homework and really look at what schools are offering them and what schools they want to go to and who they are. Sometimes guys don't even know the level of their play. I know rankings and stuff can build up a guy's head or lower a guy's self-esteem, but sometimes you really need to know your game, how you fit, where you fit, know what your goals are, and then base that off where you want to go.
And, guys, Beasley is bringing it today on the debut episode of Churkle & Company on the Sports Geeks Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. And before I let all of you go from today's edition of the show, give me your opinion on where Ray McCallum will get selected in the NBA draft this June. Kira Jones, you first on this one, and then Brendan, and then Lauren, you will go last on this one.
Okay.
So, KJ? Late first, early second, late second. Where do you see Ray going in the NBA draft? If Carrick is still with us. Carrick Jones, are you on the line with us right now? KJ. Well, Kudla, you know what? You take his spot then. Where do you see Ray McCallum going in the NBA draft?
I think his game translates very well to professional basketball in the association. Along, I think his stock is the one that could rise the most out of anyone that coming into the draft right now, coming out of University of Detroit Mercy, not exactly known for pumping out professional NBA basketball players. However, I think he can sneak into the mid to late first round with a good showing in the combine. His game translates well. He's a bigger guard. He's not going to get overmatched. And I think he has the skill set that will really play good basketball. So look for him to go at, if he has a good combine. That's a big if. He could go mid to late first round. And then if he doesn't have a good one, it could be late to mid or late to even later in the second round.
And I share the sentiment with Brendan Kudla, Lauren, that he's a late first rounder, best case scenario. And that's probably with a good showing at the combine. Your thoughts, though, on where McCallum will end up being selected in this upcoming June's NBA draft?
I'm familiar with Brandon on this one. You know, depending on how he performs at the combine, and not just him, there are other guards who have a chance to build up their upside as well. But depending on how he does and how some other guards fare, yeah, he could definitely be a late first round guy. But at this point, if his combine isn't great, or maybe other guys outshine him a little bit more at the combine because they come from bigger schools or whatnot, he'll definitely be a mid to late second round guy. But I would be shocked if he's just not drafted. That's what would surprise me. But I think he'll get drafted. Like the best case scenario, late first round. And then I think at the latest, like I said, probably a late second round. But he has potential definitely to go in the second round. I don't see him at this point not being drafted, basically.
Well, guys, thank you very much for your insight in the lively debate and discussion that you both provided. And as well as to Kira Jones also, same thing. Thanks very much for all your time and all of the great, great discussion today on the very first episode of Churkle & Company on the Sports Geeks Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. Hey, Lauren, best of luck to you with your podcast, Sports Talk with Lauren Beasley on Blog Talk Radio, which can be heard how often on BTR? When does your show air, Lauren? Beasley, Kudla, are you guys both gone? I believe both have hung up. And that is the show, the very first episode of Churkle & Company. Look forward to many great additions every Wednesday afternoon on the Sports Geeks Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com from 3 until 5 Eastern Time. Talk to you all next week. Have a good one and enjoy the upcoming weekend. Goodbye now.